Welcome to the next 8-4 Play Podcast, your first, only, best, last, greatest podcast hope about talk about Japan and games and Japanese games. I am your erstwhile host, Mark Gaming Jesus McDonald. With me, we have the regular cast, the 8-4-some five-some, I guess we are now.
Technically,
for the time being.
At the moment.
And a special guest. So, if you've been watching our Twitter account, you know who that is. But the rest of you, just stay in suspense for a while we introduce our cast of regulars, starting to my left. Roy, do you have a nickname for yourself?
I do.
Okay, good. So,
yes.
So people who haven't listened, maybe to the last podcast, or maybe the last two, since he announced he was leaving... we're down a man. J.J. Epperson is off...
He's in Walmart right now, I think.
He's in Walmart. Okay.
Yeah. Bass Pro Shop, I think.
Testing mattresses at Walmart. He's busy doing that. So in the meantime, we're going to have... I might not always be here, so we need to prepare for that day. And so we're taking on different responsibilities. We're kind of testing things out, getting people used to things. And part of that is the production values, which well, I haven't injured you yet, so you don't exist yet. But part of it is also the nicknames,
right?
And that, Roy,
that's me.
Agreed to take on.
I have
this week.
Yeah.
I think you're ready. You've been getting better.
You think so? Yeah. I've kind of been like pitching you ideas for the past few episodes now. So.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully
a lot of
all
which
that
were taken or like just riffed on for the eventual like true nicknames, and so yeah, give us what you got.
So
start with yourself.
Mine is I'm Roy Shin Megami Okubo Blakely, because I went to Shin Okubo this weekend.
Nice.
And yeah,
explain what is Shin Okubo.
So it's kind of like, I guess you'd call it like Koreatown or something
of Tokyo.
That's what it is. Yeah,
basically. Yeah,
a couple stops from Shinjuku.
Right
on the Yamanote. Easy to get to.
Super easy to get to.
Would you go
very small station?
Yeah. Yes. What did you go there for?
So, I have this friend who's from Korea, and he wanted me to try this dish called cheese takarubi, which is like
cheese takarubi.
Yeah. There you go. Graham's got it.
That's how you say it in Japanese.
Wait, sure. Is that related to
takarubi? It's. I mean, Roy should explain what it is.
Well, so yeah, basically, it's like
straight
imagine,
up sinful is what it's. Oh my god!
Imagine you have like a nabe.
It is
skillet,
decadent.
Skillet or pot, kind of.
Yes.
And then you fill the center with nothing but like shredded artificial cheese.
Holy shit!
And then
okay.
On either side, either
with
other
you so
side,
far.
You put like meat and vegetables.
And okay.
Then you heat said skillet.
Yeah.
And all that shit just becomes one glorious bubbling mass.
That's about like fondue, where everything is just bathed in cheese, or
kind of, yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like, since it's Korean, like it's got like, you know, chili sauce in it and stuff, so it's like a little spicy.
Mm.
Chicken and like, yeah.
Was it
veggies
so
and stuff?
Amazing.
It sounds
it was really
quite
good. Yeah. So, although yeah. The cheese, maybe like, you know how I mentioned it's artificial, like
yeah. Could do with a little bit better quality cheese.
I think so.
Yeah. Is it expensive? Is this like
it's a regular menu item. It's just okay. I had it a while ago too.
Yeah.
This thing is new. Like, last time I went to Koreatown, it was not there.
I've never heard of this.
And now it's just, like, it's in every store.
It's hot right
now. So I don't know when this started, but
so
it is booming.
It's not takarubi places. It's just a dish that you would get in a, like, a yakiniku joint?
Any, like, if you go to any restaurant in Koreatown, really,
okay.
Like, there will be. They will also, like, it'll be the front. Like, they'll have special menus, like, get our cheese takarubi.
Mm.
Get it.
Takarubi. So, but it's not related to the yakiniku karubi.
Maybe it is.
Okay.
I don't know.
No, it's
just like
one of the mysteries.
Basically, yeah, there's just this giant, like, it's cheese, a giant mess of meat and veggies, and then also, like, tteokbokki, like the what is it, like a pasta kind of thing?
I thought it was, like, mochi-like.
Oh, yeah, it's a mochi-like thing, yeah, they throw it in there. So, I mean, it's a good time.
I actually went there because I wanted Korean fried chicken, which is really good.
That's a big thing in Korea, where you just go out and get, like endless chicken, like, and beer, basically.
In Seoul, there are establishments that are just fried chicken and beer.
Yeah, and that chicken is legit, but my friend had their plans that day, so I ended up eating that instead, which was fine. And then I also bought an accessory for my desk.
Oh, nice.
Which is, some of us in the 8-4 office have become fans of the K-pop band Twice.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
so I got a.
Who's in?
Wait, who are these guilty parties besides you?
I mean, I'm into it now.
Okay. Yeah, so
because of Roy.
I guess it's just Graham.
Roy showed it to me.
Graham and I think Dermot might be coming up.
He's turning.
Yeah.
What is their hit? What's their big hit that people might have heard?
I mean, I like Likey personally the most.
I like Heartshaker. I think it's
Heartshaker's good too.
Okay.
Yeah.
I want to say,
but I'm coming out of Signal lately.
Signal, really?
Yeah, I like Signal.
Yeah, that's kind of an oldie but a goodie.
Yeah. Have I seen one of those big, like, 18-wheelers driving around with this band on it? The name
sounds
familiar. Really?
Well, no, probably not, but they do have one song that's been playing in, like, the Konbini lately. What is the newest one? The Japanese one that you hate?
Oh, like Sugar Cookie Pop or something.
Something like that.
It's terrible, yeah.
So they do, but the songs that you like are them singing in Korean, but they do also sing in Japanese?
Yeah, well, see, it's a pretty varied group. They have Korean girls and Japanese girls and a Taiwanese girl. Like, mm-hmm. It's international.
Oh, my
goodness.
They
have everything.
Okay.
Yeah, they're
call it K-pop is
KTJ-pop.
It's a Korean. They're based in Korea, and most of their songs are in Korean. So, you know, it is what it is.
What are they called?
Twice.
Okay.
You're so nice, you had to say it twice.
That's right.
So, did you like? What'd you buy? Like a pillow case?
I just got a desk calendar.
Oh, okay.
Of my favorite girl in the group.
What's her vital statistics, Roy? Give us like what would she like?
So, well, the main reason
likes dislikes blood type. Yeah,
I know that her nickname is Tofu because her skin is very white.
Okay.
She's the rapper in the band, which is why
Holy shit.
Like her. Yeah.
Oh wow. How is her flow?
Oh, it's legit.
Really?
She's good. Yeah.
I'm sure it is.
Apparently, it's easier to rap in Korean. Something about the way that the sentence structure
like
works.
Japanese is also easy mode for rapping
because the syllables
sound,
are all
you can only end on one of six sounds, so it's like it's pretty easy to put things together. But.
Right on. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you're part of the job now, Roy, is you also have to move on to other people's nicknames.
Yeah, okay.
When,
so
when the time is right.
Yeah, segue.
I'll segue. Okay.
Does Graham also get some twice character-related
No,
name,
so Graham is Graham Hashpipe Howard.
Oh, yeah, because of all that hash you smoke.
All of it.
That's right.
Okay, John's.
There's no hash left for anyone else. Yeah.
Wait, you don't want to know the story?
No, he smokes a shit ton of hash. We know that. Go
but
on.
He did so.
Go
he
ahead.
Did so internationally recently.
So last episode, there was a person who's like, "Give us the McDonald's tip," and I felt bad that I couldn't deliver.
Yeah.
So I went to Taiwan a couple weeks ago, and I hit up a McDonald's in Taipei, and I had both of the Gente burgers, and so you've got chicken and beef.
Do you want to describe what Gente means?
Gente, sorry, it's a limited time only burger. So that they swap them out. And in Taipei, I had both kinds, and basically this is a like black pepper barbecue sauce burger that has a whole hash brown on it.
Okay.
And that comes in beef and it was awesome. It was great.
Mm.
And, I just wanted to let everybody know that's what's going on.
So what was the other one?
In Taipei.
Beef and chicken. Those are the two. Like, you have two varieties of the black pepper barbecue sauce hash brown burger.
So which one was better?
See, this is tough. I usually go for the chicken burger because, everybody knows that McDonald's does the best chicken fillets in the business. But the beef burger.
Okay, direct your what do you think about that to what's your Tiny Howard on Twitter. Please, not 8-4.
But I think I like the beef one more because you had that, like the consistency, the texture was kind of like similar throughout the bun and the hash brown and the beef. So you could just enjoy this combination of flavors and focus on that without having to go through the different kinds of consistency.
I'd be careful opening your mail for the next few weeks. Like the Chick-fil-A people are out there and they are fucking scary. Okay?
McDonald's is
scary.
The best in the business, man. They're incredible.
All right. Timely Howard on Twitter, folks. Right. What else?
Speaking of Chick-fil-A, we've got John Miracle and Ice Ricciardi. You got really excited today about
defeating the Canadians.
So
did we do it?
We did.
I don't even know.
Nice.
You were very excited about hockey.
The American ladies beat the Canadian ladies.
All right.
Unfortunately, I mean, it was actually a really good game, and it went to overtime, and then to a shootout, and then to a single shootout because all of them were tied at the end.
Holy shit!
But in the single shootout, America prevailed.
I saw U.S. versus Canada, so that's what that was.
That's always just exciting because Canada's supposed to win everything when it comes to hockey. So when the U.S. it's like the first time ever that the U.S. got the gold in women's hockey. So
that's
the first time in 20 years. One of those
20
two.
Years,
maybe
yeah.
that. Yeah, which for some of us at the
Still
table
impressive.
Is ever.
So just to bring it all together, probably John, you're the only other person that's old enough to remember this, but do you remember, I think it was the Los Angeles Summer Olympics, was that either 82 or 85?
84.
Oh 84, where McDonald's had a promotion, which is when the U.S. team won a gold medal.
Something was free, right?
You got free shit.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
You got cards and you scratched it off and what you would get. And that year, fucking America won everything. Everything. It was some crazy record year. And so, yeah, for like an 11-year-old, it was basically like the fucking most amazing thing ever. So, Graham, maybe someday, I don't know, something similar will happen to you. But
toward the Tokyo Olympics, maybe they'll do a thing
there. There you go. There you go. Black peppers fucking raining from the sky. Go ahead, Rook. Next nickname.
Speaking of raining from the sky, we've got Dermot Root Seeker Cregan.
Root down.
So, Dermot, you've been on a bit of a journey, a personal journey, where you've been trying to find what retro games you think might appeal to you that you haven't played yet.
Yeah.
The other day at lunch, it opened up quite a discussion between everybody in the office.
Really?
All vying for Dermot's time.
So what did
retro RPGs in particular, right?
Yeah.
So what did you end up as your top, like, top three? Give me the top three.
Oh, I think from Graham, I got Suikoden.
Yeah.
So I'm going to count that as one because Suikoden 1 and 2. They're kind of just a package deal.
Yeah. I approve.
Overrated, but okay.
Keep
going,
buddy.
Keep going.
Breath of Fire was up there.
I'm going to just... Now, without knowing what you've played or not played, I'm going to take issue with Breath of Fire.
So did you say Breath of Fire 1?
No.
Which one specifically?
Breath of Fire 3.
Yeah,
okay.
Right.
Breath of Fire 1 is rough.
Yeah, I thought you were talking about Breath of Fire 1. Breath of Fire 3. Can skip cute. It. If somebody says if somebody said Ark the Lad, I hope you fucking smack them in the mouth.
No one.
That's not going to be the third one, right?
No one came with that one, no.
All right, good.
It's Final Fantasy. I haven't decided which one I'm going to go for.
So I was going to ask... Like, to start it off, I just assume you'd played all the Final Fantasies, like, especially 4 through 7.
Well, so this is the thing. Like, I'm on this journey because I have, like, a pretty glaring blind spot in my classic games, and especially classic RPGs. Mm. The only Final Fantasy I've played is 15.
Okay. Let's go back and revisit your little list here, then, in light of that. Suikoden falls down to, like, maybe it's still in the top 100. I'm not sure. But
there haven't even been 95 Final
Fantasies. It's probably on the bubble. No, but like knowing that you haven't played all of those Final Fantasies tells me that you haven't played like a lot of other shit.
I'd say so, but like the thing is, and the important factor here is that I don't like grinding, and a lot of those games haven't aged well to the point where like I could go back and play them, but I'm not going to enjoy it. So
okay, fair enough.
Those are only like 3 Final Fantasy games are worth playing.
You're talking about 4, 5, and 6,
basically, and Tactics. So 4. I revised that to 4. There are 4.
But like a younger generation would argue 10.
Wrongly,
Shane Bettenhouse in front of the show. God bless him. Would argue 10. But I don't
call out Roy.
Younger generation.
Yeah. I think 10 would be a good fit for Dermot because it stars basically an underwater soccer player. Dermot's an above-ground soccer player.
Wait, but if you don't...
There's also some...
Other fiddles.
Yeah.
If you don't like grinding, I'm going to maybe say 4 and 5 are not going to...
You don't have to grind in 4.
No, 4 is fine. You can,
really?
You
super fast-paced, yeah.
Okay.
5, yeah, you got to grind.
I mean...
Levels and jobs.
Yeah. Mm. So, but that which sucks because you'd be missing... Maybe that's the game that would teach you to love the grind.
But I don't love the grind.
But
you don't want to love the grind.
What game hurt you with the grind? Which game? Where did you learn this language of hate? What was your
That is a good question. I don't know.
Zero Monkey.
Maybe you do like it.
No, I know I don't. I think I remember like the most recent one is like I was playing Persona 4, and I got to a point like really late game where I couldn't beat the boss because I wasn't a high enough level. And I feel like at that point, if I have been playing the game how I want to play it. And I can't progress, then
that sounds like poor design.
Exactly, yeah. The designers are inflating the game.
Suikoden has a weighted leveling system. If you fight one battle, it'll put you up to where you need to be.
Mm. Well, so I'm into that.
I actually really like Suikoden.
108 characters.
You don't need to get them all.
I know. I'm not.
Grimio.
Trust me. I'm exaggerating for comedic effect, arguably comedic effect. But I do think that. I mean, Suikoden is held in such crazy, crazy high regard that it's a good, interesting game.
I think
it's
the internet will have my back on this one again.
Well, probably.
Like I was right about Mega Man X.
Probably.
Oh, I thought you were
going
to talk about the chicken because like they're not going to have your back on the chicken.
They
Chick-fil-A is king, man.
Not Mega
Did they have Chick-fil-A
either.
In Canada? Maybe that's why.
Maybe not. Yeah.
That could be a thing.
We had like a Wendy's.
And finally, rounding out the cast, very quietly, patiently waiting. As he had for many years since his last appearance on this show at, I think, the PlayStation Vita launch. That's right, folks. Yes.
Wow, we're going back.
Friend of the show, director of Evil Within DLC 1 and 2, or just 2?
1 and 2.
1 and 2. And the Evil Within 2 proper. That is John Jojo Johannes. Jojo, thank you for finally being on the show. We promised it around when the game came out, which seems like so long ago now. Last Halloween-ish, October 13th.
So long ago, yes.
Right? Friday the 13th.
Color has returned to your skin.
And now that, you know, the timing is right, you released a little something-something out there, a little FPS patch.
Yeah, it was a Valentine's Day gift.
That was the thinking behind it.
Yeah, we released a free DLC upgrade for the Evil Within 2 that allows you to play through the entire game in a first-person mode.
So I want to talk about that, but I want to talk about a million other things leading up to that. But before we do that, and that's going to be the lion's share of the show today, is talking about Evil Within 1 and 2, you know, horror, survival horror game dev, Japanese game dev, John Johannes game dev, all of those topics, you know, that everybody talks about on Reddit all the time.
Of course, yeah.
The John Johannes subreddit. But before that, let's just quickly, like, hit the games that we've been playing, a.k.a. Let's talk about Monster Hunter World for
another hour.
Yeah, 10 minutes or so. Where are we all at? I'm actually, like, Hunter rank-wise, embarrassingly close to where I was last episode, but I have played a bunch more since then. I'm like 14 now, I think.
So I'm 14 now too, and I think so is Roy, right? Are you 13 or 14?
Beat Nergy, whatever that makes you.
So yeah, we're all right in the same spot, which is great. I did as well. You did as well. I think you were there when my team beat it.
Right.
JoJo, you are right around there?
We beat it together too, actually.
Yes, we actually played online together.
Okay, yeah. So you beat Nergigante as well. Actually, they pronounce Nergigante, how do they pronounce his name in the game? They pronounce it a little bit differently than I've been thinking.
Isn't it Nergigante?
Maybe it was.
Nergigante, are you thinking it's like
some kind of, I don't know, yeah, they do like the tortilla thing or something where they're like,
Nergigante!
Yeah, or something like that. Which was a really fun fight, I have to say. Like,
yeah, he's a badass.
So you saw the video that I talked about last podcast, right? The cartoon
about
how to fight Nergigante that was made at the demo. That thing is so totally accurate, which I had seen this cartoon joke thing on, you can find on YouTube about it. Maybe we'll link to it in the show notes. About how he just leaps entirely across the map and just pounces on people and just kills them.
He's like a cat.
Yeah, and I'm a heavy bow gunner, and so every once in a while, you know, you have this super special shot which can do a ton of damage, but it takes a long time to load. But I'm very used to just being all the way across the map and just taking my sweet time loading, not even thinking about it. And, like, exactly true to form to that thing, he was like, burr, burr. He's like, see his little head turn from way the fuck far away and just whoosh, bam, like, just knocked the shit out of me, which was like a new wrinkle and an interesting thing. His dive bomb attack too, I had from that video an impression of it that he would fly up and, like, float there for a while, like, hey, everybody,
same.
I'm about to do my dive bomb attack, here it comes, everybody start running because it's coming, here go, boom, dive bomb attack. It was just like boom, and I was fucking killed. And actually, I think it ruined my first time. Like, we wiped, basically.
There is a pretty long tail.
I think he roars
for the dive bomb. He roars and he's up in the air. Like,
no,
I think you're just not looking for it.
I didn't notice it myself. He didn't stay up long.
There must be different versions of it, because he just went up and then immediately it just looked like he jumped like a normal jump. Like, it's, I swear
that happened to me too. And so I was telling everybody, oh, I guess I fought him, I went this whole fight and I never saw it, and I thought I didn't see it, but then it turns out he had done it a bunch of times, but he didn't stay up, he just went up and then went down and, like, basically, like, wiped people out. So
I mean, I can tell that you guys are the reason I only do them solo.
Hey, I never lost to Nergigante, so
you must have variations or something like that. You did get killed in our Nergigante fight.
Gaijin Hunter did a video on it, on that attack specifically.
Oh yeah,
the show.
And he did say that there's a tell where he roars before he does it, so, like,
so maybe he roars before he jumps up.
Yeah,
okay, yeah, that I'm, like, probably just completely ignoring.
Or he might have been out of the range of the roar or something, so it seemed more seamless.
So my pro tip of the week, or of the episode this time, something that I didn't know for the first 40 hours through, and I'm curious if other people did. So loadouts, which I had always planned to eventually get to using, right? Like, you can have set loadouts that you go to and refresh and just immediately grabs that equipment and those items from you. If you're in your box and you hit the, I guess...
Triangle?
Yeah, no. What does triangle do?
Are you trying to like organize your hot bar?
No. Not that. I was a heavy bow gunner, and so every time it's going back and fucking okay,
refilling your ammo.
Yes, let's refill this type. Let's refill that type. Yeah. No. But I have to go and find which one I used all of. And then it's a pain in the ass. Like the UI is okay. Like it grays out things that you are already moved over all and X's out things that bow can't use. But it's still difficult because there's different ammo shares colors and it's not super clear. They're all kind of blended together. So what you can do though, and you can do this not just for bow gunning, but for everything. Like if you have a loadout that you like every time, like you take two traps or maybe you take some well-done meat, or you want to refill on your, like, the max up thing. I forget what it's called, the little triangle
max
thing.
Max potion?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is, like, super fucking key.
Right.
Because you swallow it so fast. Right, like, it's not like a
better than a potion.
Plus,
potion.
It maxes your health bar.
And that, too. Or, you know what, I'm thinking of I think it's an ancient potion.
Okay, yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah, which is also
stamina,
really great.
Yeah.
So, but if you hit the... what's the start button on a PlayStation controller
options.
Called? Options. Yeah.
That's where you can record your...
If you hit it there, it just immediately goes to, okay, here, now record your loadout.
Nice, I never did that.
And then you just save it, and then you can attach a name to it. So you can say, like, even with different heavy bow guns, they can all use different ammo. So I can call this one, like, I call it, like, HBG, and then Kodachi or whatever, like, that bow gun is. And then the heavy bow gun, like, nice. Diablos or whatever. And so... instantly, rather than every time. I mean, it was only maybe not even a minute, but it was just something you kind of dreaded doing between missions, and other people with different weapons were much quicker to be able to do it and stuff. So that, if you're not using it, and also the quick menu.
The radials,
if you're not using those...
Oh, I use the radios all the time, but I do constantly like accidentally gesture when I because Graham gave me this idea, which is really helpful. But my up and down radials are actual items, and left and right are gestures. And like after a match is done, especially with SOSs, I'll like usually just like clap or something because people helped out.
Okay.
And a lot of times, then the next match, I forget to go back to the items, and like I need to like use a whetstone or something, and then my guy starts clapping or whatever.
Yeah,
and
I
get smacked.
Yeah.
To add on to your comment about loadouts. One of my friends named Ryan, I retweeted him on Twitter, but he found out that your radials and your hotbar, like you can customize that too, like the order of it, all that stuff ties into your loadout.
Saves that as well.
Yeah.
That's fucking awesome because
so you can have a different like radial setup completely with each loadout?
Yeah.
Wow. And
that's amazing because per weapon, it's absolutely different. Like, I don't even need whetstones. So,
right.
and the ammo needs, it's like two whole radials in of its own. That's great. Yeah. That thing is very much a, like, it's totally worth your time to go in and do that. I put it off for so long, way too long, and I got killed so many times cycling through, especially with all of the different ammos and stuff, but cycling through to find the right healing potion and stuff like that. I died so many goddamn times. So I will say now I need some item if I want to like get the Diablos bow gun all the way, which is one of the most damage dealing bow guns in the game. I need some like spiral horn, which apparently Black Diablos, which first of all is a total bitch, literally is a bitch. Every
you know it's a Diablos
time.
In heat, right? That's like the whole thing. So that's why it's like basically like agitated all the time.
That's also why it's literally a bitch.
Yes.
But like yeah, angry all the time, and even then you have to break the horns, of course. And then even then it's only like an 8% drop. And you need three of them or something.
Isn't there some gear you
it's
can
ridiculous.
Get that ups the drop rate? Was it Legiana or something?
There is a cape too, right? Where you can get the special
the bandit.
Not the bandit one. Oh. That one is that one just gets you money. That one gets you stuff that you can sell for money.
Yeah,
I think that one. Oh, it's just money. I thought it like you shoot off carves with like a certain percentage or something, and then you could just sell the carves.
Well, it does. It knocks off things that you can only sell. The other thing that you get from the. What is it called? The like infected land one from the
Rotten Vale.
The Rotten Vale, the native Grim Likes or whatever they're called.
Oh, you're talking about for your cat, maybe?
No. It's a mantle that you wear. Or no, I'm sorry. I am talking about for your cat.
Yeah.
This thing is for your cat.
The Plunder Blade.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. And you have your cat equip it, mm-hmm. and it can just be carving off rare shit throughout the entire... Mm. I really need that thing.
It's great.
You already got it?
Yeah.
God damn it.
Well, the quest to get it is a little unclear compared to the other ones.
Mm.
Like, there's a part where...
I feel like I need to be taking notes.
You have to leave the meat out for them in the Rotten Vale. But in order for them to even appear in the first place in the Rotten Vale... You have to have done, I think, the other Grimlike quests up until that point.
I think so. I'm not really sure. It just happened for me, and I never wanted to look it up, but that sounds right.
Bastard.
I did have all the other ones by the time I got it, so that might be a requirement.
So where are you guys at? JoJo, what are you going after right now? Where are you at in the game?
I don't know. I'm just kind of playing until the end. I don't really have an end game plan.
But there's no end.
There's the last
boss, Monster Hunter.
Right, from what I hear.
I mean, there's a...
You run out of stuff to do.
So you don't have like weapon or armor goals. You're just like, I just want to see the credits.
I started looking into it and it got really complicated. So I was just like, there's
too
many skills.
That's why you need other people to play with that are way more into it than you. To go on the wiki and be like, oh man, what are you using? What's your weapon of choice?
I use the dual blades.
Oh, right. Okay. You use the dual blades. So yeah. I don't have any close friend dual bladers. Roy, do you have any dual blade?
My girlfriend likes dual blades. Focus is a good skill. It makes your gauge fill faster.
Okay.
Probably evasion up would be good.
Again, I probably need a notebook.
Yeah. See, I found what I was talking about last episode, and I've found these pockets now where people are very specifically talking about the things that I want to know, like bowgunner builds.
Where did you find them?
And you can find the crazy, crazy shit. So one of them, there are a couple different wikis that have discussions going on. Also, the Reddit is pretty good. Mm. But one of the problems is that bowgunning changed a bunch after the patch. Mm. And so you have a lot of people talking about stuff
that's no longer valid.
Before the patch, that's attached to like slicing. It was all about slicing ammo. And it still is kind of to a certain extent, but not as much as it was. Mm. And so there's whole builds kind of built around that. And I was watching videos with guys just like with some of the builds that you can create are super scary. Like affinity, which seems like kind of a bullshit stat.
No, affinity is really important.
Which is like how often you kind of critically hit, right? Yeah. So how often you do more damage. When you get that really high and there's tons of different ways to boost that. You can basically, there's builds that get that to essentially like 100%.
Hmm.
So every time you hit, you're hitting for this like way higher tier of damage.
Yeah.
Whether it's the weak point or not, or like there's so many different ways to tailor your...
I got the affinity slider, I guess it was a decoration maybe, and I put it on my hammer, and I like to slide and do the sliding attacks on the hammer, so now whenever I start sliding, the affinity thing kicks in, and like my shit just like wrecks, and it's awesome. Hmm. Like it feels so good.
So wait, so while you're physically sliding, you have like a...
You know,
really high affinity?
Yeah, your affinity goes up only while you're sliding. Or like maybe it's like while you slide and then for a couple seconds after or something. But like basically with a hammer, like the best thing to do for me, the funnest thing to do is get monsters in range of a hill and basically just constantly do that crazy spinning attacks.
The move coming out of a slide is like the greatest feeling ever if you hit a monster.
Well, and especially if you could like mount, like you smack them around and then you land on them and mount them and everything. It's just like so much fun. I'm at the point in the game now. I mean, I'm at the kind of the same area as you guys, but... Which is low. I mean, most people have already totally destroyed the game and are super high rank, but, like, we've all been kind of
playing.
Well,
I mean, most people, our friends are not, like, a...
Most people we know, but yeah. But
I know a lot of people. I'm always surprised when other people... I mean, I'm happily surprised that everybody here is around my same level, because I just expect everybody to be off in fucking, like, Hunter rank 49, you know.
Right.
200, like...
But I'm at the part of the game now that's where it becomes really fun for me, because I am specifically going for, like, every hammer that... Basically every line of hammer. Like, I want one of everything, basically. One of everything good, anyway. And, like, that just makes you focus on which monsters you're gonna fight, and, like...
So who are you after now?
Well, I'm after a bunch. I have, like, 3 or 4, actually, that I'm working on. And I love that the game lets you mark them, too, so you can kind of, like, know when you get the items. But, like, I've been doing... I've also been clearing out the quests on my thing, because... just to, like, clear out my quest log. And, like, I've been basically just doing a lot of stuff and then SOSing 3 other people in and then just, like, gathering items and, like, trying to build up hammers. And so that's why I haven't progressed that much, but it's been really fun, because I'm just,
that's
like,
what I'm all about. Me neither. But when I get on, I'm like, I want to do the... We talked about this last episode, but I want to do the thing that I want to do. So I'm not going to wait and get there myself. I'll just join an SOS.
Well, another pro tip is like so the bandit mantle that we talked about earlier that gets you money. Like if you need money, because it costs money. Like once you start, especially when you get a high rank, like some of that gear is expensive.
A lot of money.
Get a bandit mantle, and then actually, if you can, get four people with bandit mantles, and then go fight Great Jagras and just pound the shit out of him, and he will just drop tons of gold. Like
Great Jagras, especially.
Because he's the easiest. He's right where he is in the map. You just run there and beat the crap out of him, and then collect. Everybody gets everybody's thing. So if you have four people doing it, you just get tons of gold block drops.
I love it so much when somebody else is wearing that. When you find one, you're like, fuck yeah, somebody else is wearing the bandit mantle.
And then go sell them, and you just have tons of money, like, instantly. So it's a really good way to get money.
Yeah. I wish you could filter or, like, buy a request for that, like... Hey, other people wear bandit mantles. Like, you can't name your room. I don't know. Maybe I haven't made an online session. Can you name your rooms? Like, you used to be able to in the old Monster Hunters, right? Yeah. You could be like bandit mantle party. Like, you used to be able to kind of do that kind of stuff.
Yeah, not anymore.
I am a little sad that they haven't patched out some of the stupid stuff that I'm kind of hoping they would fix in terms of the online functionality. You know, I still hate it. When I get on and I'm running around town alone, even though I'm playing kind of, you know, ostensibly with other people.
Yeah.
Why? Many of the things about the online system are fixable. Like, they seem patchable. But when does Devil Joe hit? Do we know?
They just said spring. Okay. So we're almost at spring. One more month. Presumably March. I don't know. They did just announce that there's going to be a Monster Hunter talk at GDC. They're going to show some footage of the game in development that they never showed before.
The director
of the game will be there.
That should be cool.
So, yeah.
Right on. Anything else in the Monster Hunter world? No? Graham, you're still done with it?
I mean, yeah, I haven't played it since last podcast.
You didn't come in for the Street Fighter attire, which makes no sense for this game?
No, I mean, there's no fist weapons.
Did you get that?
I'm working on it, but I didn't know I could get it yet. I just want to have it less. To have it. Like, I'm not going to wear it.
If the game had fist weapons, then that'd be fun.
Yeah, that does seem like the next thing they should do is some kind of... I mean, dual blades are kind of the closest thing to, like, using your fist, but it's not the same. But like,
apparently, obviously. If you put the outfit on, you can do...
A shuriken and shit?
The shuriken and the uppercut?
Shuriken is the uppercut.
So. No, you know the hadouken and the uppercut.
Nice.
Really?
Nice.
Yeah. I've seen people, like, there's clips of people killing monsters with those. And
the quest itself plays, like, the Ryu theme from Street Fighter, which is, like, whatever. But the quest is kind of stupid, so it's, like, a giant Baroth.
It just doesn't seem like a good match to me. I mean, I'm sure there was...
It's weird. It makes no sense. Yeah. But, I mean,
it's a Capcom property. It's free. Just throw it in there. Why not?
Yeah, well, Mega Man's coming, and I mean, I'm a little more interested in that one. I want my cat to look like a Mega Man character.
That's bad too, though.
You mean because it looks bad, or because, but I mean, at least I can have a cute Mega Man cat. Like, that at least is worth it to me. I don't want my cat to look like Ken or Ryu or whatever.
I just want them to look like they're in Monster Hunter, and like, I don't want other games infecting Monster Hunter.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah,
there are Monster Hunter costumes in Street Fighter V now. It's cross pollination. Everything's everywhere. Yep.
Huh.
Yep.
Which characters all?
Ken gets a Rathalos outfit and
Does he have like the mask or something? Or is it
he's
just
full
like...
body armor, full Rathalos?
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and Ibuki and Armika also get some kind of costumes.
Huh.
Yeah.
So Graham, what you've been playing instead of?
Well, I mean,
speak its name. Graham.
I decided it was time to graduate, take
say
a step
its name
up from
three
Monster
time,
Hunter. I've been playing the Secret of Mana remake.
Ooh. All right. So
I picked it up on Vita. And it's been my train game for a while. Okay. I finished it the other day.
Oh, wow.
It's
how long did it take you?
12 hours.
Okay,
so it's still the same game. It's always been, you know, it's a Super Nintendo action RPG.
Yeah, in my mind, it took me so long to play through that game for reasons that
somebody
talked
playing
about on the podcast. But
for the first time, it might take them a little bit more time, but it's not like Secret of Mana has side quests anyway. Like, the game just has the content in it.
It wasn't always clear where to go next,
exactly.
though, I feel like.
Yeah.
That was
no,
the thing that kept me playing for a while.
So after you're, like, flying around on Flammy and stuff, like, you can get lost and just, like, go random locations and not know what
but
to do.
But you know
That's
the
true.
Game well enough
yeah.
to know
because,
exactly
I mean,
what to do next.
I have a long history with the game.
Yep.
Like, I got it for my 6th birthday or something.
Oh, wow.
So it was, like, the first game I remember actually asking my mom for.
Nice.
There was a used copy in a Radio Shack, and I was like,
oh, wow.
I want that.
Wait, Radio Shack sold used stuff?
Yep.
I didn't know Radio Shack sold anything.
At our local mall in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, the Radio Shack had a used copy of Secret of Mana. And I don't know why I wanted it. It was probably because I saw it in Nintendo Power or something, but I was like, I want that.
Did you get the 3-player tap as well with it?
No. All I got was the cart. And I only ever played it by myself. But, yeah, no, so it's a game I know.
You never even played a 2-player.
Not until much, much later.
Wow.
Yeah, until I was like in high school, and I was like, asked a friend if they wanted to try it out, but...
Wow, you yeah, no, so didn't have any friends? Or?
No, I did, but, yeah. You know, it's, I was also back then not as into games, so I was also, like, going outside and doing things.
Uh-huh.
I grew out of that, too.
But, thank God.
But, yeah, no, so, I mean, I know the game, like, inside and out, and I still play it. I play the Super Nintendo version every few years.
That's cool.
But, yeah, no, getting into the new one, obviously it came out and people were not super hot on it, because it looks the way it does.
Mm.
And you got the Vita one, too, right? Which is, like, the worst of the two.
Wait, what's...
It performs very poorly. It's on PS4 and PC and Vita.
Yeah.
And the game usually just, like, runs at a solid 60.
Yeah.
PS Vita hangs out around, like, mid-20s.
Oh, boy. It's not even 30.
Not even 30.
Wow, Jesus.
And it's totally
Christ.
Unlocked. So if you're in like a small area, like inside a shop or something, then you'll see it at 60. It's like, oh, this is what other people get to enjoy. But yeah, no, it's
Man.
The game, I mean, it looks the way it looks. And it sounds... The music is all across the board. Like, the original game had a fantastic soundtrack.
Yes.
In the new game, they took all the original compositions and they had like over a dozen people do arrangements of it.
Oh my God.
So it's all over
including the original guy, too. He did a few as
well,
right?
Kikuta? I think so.
Kikuta-san is in there, yeah.
Kikuta, yeah.
Oh.
So, it, like, Yuzo Koshiro and a whole bunch of other guys you've never heard of, they all got in there and they made some tracks. So there are excellent ones. There are some that I think are better than the original game. And there are awful ones, and there's everything in between. But you can also switch it to the original soundtrack whenever you want, the Super Nintendo music.
Yeah.
That's good, at least.
So graphics and sound aside, it is the exact same game.
Right.
Like, the nuts and bolts are all the exact same. They really didn't add anything except those weird interstitial inn conversations whenever you go to sleep at an inn.
Oh, those are new. So those are new.
Those are brand new, yeah. So they added some stuff. It basically, like, reminds you where you are in the game.
Right.
So, like, if you don't play for a while, you'll come back and they'll be like, wow, Santa Claus exists.
Right.
Because Santa Claus is still in the game.
That's right.
I forgot about that, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, like, it's just been neat to see, like, the reception to it, because scores are obviously also pretty across the board. And I think it's just, like, whether or not you still appreciate this 25-year-old game today, because it plays the exact same.
I don't know if it's a matter of that or not, because I think it's not even, like... It's not even a universal... Like, I'm a huge, huge, huge Secret of Mana nut, and I have no fucking whatsoever interest in playing this game.
Me neither. I jumped on it because everybody else was so down on it, and I wanted to give it a shot. Mm-hmm. And, like, the first 30 minutes or so were really bad.
Mm.
And I just... It was different, and I didn't like that. But then after I kept playing it, it was like, oh, it's the exact same thing. It has the exact same charm, and I like the same things about it that I did.
It doesn't have the same charm, because it looks completely fucking terrible.
It looks fine.
I mean, a lot of the charm was the... part of the charm, maybe.
Don't you still get the old graphics in the map screen or something like that?
Yeah,
or,
like, there's like a little mini-map that shows you the SNES graphics. But, like, the overhead, like, it's pretty pulled out, too. Like, overall, graphically, I think it's pretty okay when it's not in the cutscenes that actually, like, zoom in on characters.
Yeah.
And the monster design is actually pretty good. Like, I like the little monsters and how they animate and stuff. There's a lot of character in there.
Mm.
But, it's...
I mean, I feel like any merits that it has are derived from the original game. Like, I feel like nothing is added to it. Do you feel like something was added to it that's
No,
better?
It is the exact same game, but
no,
it has
but I mean,
different
well,
terms
they added
of, like,
voice acting, I
they
guess,
added voice
right?
acting, sure.
But I mean, added to it in the sense of, like, improved upon or
nope.
better.
Nope.
Right?
It's the exact same thing.
Which is, like, yeah.
Which is good and bad. I imagine, like, this is the producer of it. This is his third time remaking Secret of Mana. He did it for feature phones, and then for cell phones, and then again for Vita.
Right.
He just loves that game, and he wants to deliver that game to a new generation.
Yeah.
Like, that exact experience.
That's fine,
yeah.
But choose an art style that befits it, and...
This is what they could, afford.
Complements it, and, you know.
The art style, and like, I didn't mind it. Like, thought it was fine.
I still think the Switch, they should just localize the Switch version, with that, which has all three games, in the original form, but looking very nice and running well,
yeah.
and with a bunch of options, and, like, put that out. That would be, like, perfect.
I mean, there are a lot of people out there that haven't played it. If I was going to recommend checking out the game to, like, somebody who hasn't seen it before, it's kind of like I'm half and half. Because they're, like...
Really?
Yeah, I mean, the remake for it, I think, probably works well for a younger generation.
Right.
Because going back and playing a Super Nintendo game with those graphics would be a turnoff. And since it is the same, like, basically the exact same experience, no matter which one you play,
I don't know
for a younger person, like, I might be... Play the thing on the system you have. And if that happens to be a PS4, play that.
All
right.
Well,
and you have it on Japanese, right?
Yes.
So because I saw some videos of the English and the voice acting.
Oh, it's hideous.
Like they got like people
awful.
To just go in the basement and record. Like it was atrocious.
Some of the
bad.
Worst
like,
I've ever heard. Yeah.
Yeah. It's I don't know if the whole game's like that though, because I just people just post the clips of the really bad stuff. So
but
it's just like, how do you screw something like that up that bad?
Right. Oh boy. Okay. Yeah. I mean, that makes me want to hear it.
I actually
want to
play. I'm going to play it. I think, but I want to play it on PS4. If I'm going to play it, I don't want to play it on Vita, especially if it's that.
Yeah, Vita performance issues, and it's extremely buggy. So it's very faithful to the original in that respect as well. Yeah.
That's fantastic.
I think I got like 10 crashes. Like just straight up the game just, bricks. Which was cool. But it auto-saves every single time you change a room, so I didn't lose anything for it, but still.
Okay. Well, palate cleanser. Let's get off of this. This
Secret of Mana, still a good game.
Let's time travel back to... When did Thief Within 1 come out? Actually, okay, we're going to dig into JoJo now. We're going to dig into JoJo Town.
I'm ready.
Yep, you ready?
I'm ready.
You've been quietly biding your time over there, very politely biting your tongue, not talking shit about anybody else's games.
Every game is fantastic.
We can talk shit about your games now. I want to dig into the whole Evil Within 1, all the DLC, 2 especially. We have a bunch of reader questions here as well. But why don't we start off just talking about you, why you came to Japan, how you ended up working at Tango. Like, what's your deal, man? What's your story?
My major in university, I double majored. One was international economics, but the other one was East Asian studies, and I studied Japanese when I was in...
Why?
I just wanted to. I went to Japan when I was in high school.
Oh, okay.
One of my elementary school friends was Japanese, moved back with their family, and we stayed in touch, and I got invited to
her
come
family.
Over. Yeah.
Is there some romance? some hot high school nights? What's that Grease song?
No.
What a.
That's his next game.
Yeah, so anyway.
No romance at all?
No. What are
you
talking about?
You came to Japan for this girl.
No, I came to Japan for other reasons. I just enjoyed it.
So she spurned you.
Yeah.
Even though you came
We're obviously
all the
friends.
Way.
I'm friends with her family. It's
okay.
Nice.
All right.
Anyway, so when I was in university, I studied Japanese. My third year, I studied in Kyoto. So I was there for a year. I lived with a homestay family.
Did you experience the Kyoto freeze? The famous.
What, how cold it is there?
No. Like that all the people are. Cold, unfeeling.
No, I actually feel maybe Tokyo is a little bit more colder than Kyoto. But
yeah, I hear both ways. But there is like a thing, right? The reputation Kyoto people.
I think it's specifically towards Tokyo people, though, right? Like Kyoto people specifically do not like Tokyoites.
No, I think it's just more in general, though. I mean, there's that, but there's a thing about Kyoto in general where it's like the people are all like. Snooty and like, I mean, deserved or undeserved, there's like a reputation around people being cold.
I don't know, I can't really say. I never felt that way when I was there, so
each region just shits on the other. It goes both ways.
So what were you studying just Japanese while you were there?
Yeah, it was Japanese, other courses about Japan. But
what'd you think about Kyoto?
I loved it.
You did?
You know, it's a really nice place. You kind of think of it as like a nice place to retire to because it's not too much there. It's there's not a lot of job. Obviously, there's places to work, but it's not like a bustling city of business,
right?
In that respect,
right.
And it almost feels like you go there for a weekend
tourism,
to like relax. Yeah,
it drives a lot of the city, and like there's not a lot of like big factories. I mean, obviously, everybody knows it from Nintendo, and that is there, and there are businesses there, but it's not. Yeah, there's not like a big bustling center of entrepreneurship or industry or stuff like that. It's all shuffled off to like Osaka and surrounding.
Yeah. But size wise, you know, it's big enough that you can know the entire city. You can bike around it. Visually, it's a fantastic looking place because it has all the cultural locations and it's created on a grid, so you know where you're going.
That's true. Yeah,
that
nice. That's pretty amazing.
Thanks, China.
So there's lots of great stuff about it. The only down point you could say is that because it is so small, you know, if you're there all the time, you kind of almost run out of things to do.
Mm.
But you know, with the bullet train, everything's so convenient. It's not really a bad point. But I go there a lot, just if I have a weekend or something. Yeah, I'll just go to a restaurant I liked or just walk around.
Still got
just,
friends there?
Yes, I visit the program that I studied abroad with. I say hey to the staff, and there are a couple people who are there. But sometimes, even if they're not in town, I just go to a cafe or something.
What is your top? Give me the top restaurant pick. Kyoto that you wouldn't know about necessarily if you hadn't.
I just went recently. There's this restaurant called Hafu, which is a steak place. It's all Japanese meat, and you can get a course.
Not hats, not like beef that was had one parent from America.
No, unfortunately, no. I don't even know what the kanji is for it. I don't know, but it was recommended to me. It's kind of a very low key place. It's kind of in the middle of nowhere, and it's a little bit hard to get a reservation. And I think the course meal is kind of expensive. It's like about $100 or ichiman.
Okay.
So like it's a wagyu steak. Like they bring out a proper.
Well, it's like a whole series of different meats that you get like a whole course, and everything they gave was just absolutely fantastic. It was blown away.
No,
all right, that's on the list.
Yeah, so put it on the list.
We're going there. Oh, it's going to get crowded because of the 8-4 bump now.
Yeah,
all of our fucking out. Hundreds of thousands of listeners just bustling in there
in Kyoto.
All right, so you come back, you graduate from where?
So I went to Brandeis University outside of Boston. And when I was in
Boston,
yeah,
you're a East Coaster.
I'm from Long Island.
Yeah. Okay.
But when I was in Kyoto, I did a lot of work studying Japanese, and I went back to graduate. So my senior year was back in the States, and I still wanted to pursue this sort of the Japanese field. I actually wanted to do translation in literature because I did a lot of Japanese literature studying. But when I was back in the States, I kept feeling like because you never practice Japanese in the States.
Right.
So I kept feeling like my ability was diminishing by day. So I was like, oh my God, I got to go back there, even just a little bit to get my skill level so it's not going to diminish.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied to, as most people do to get them back here, I applied to the JET program.
Okay.
Okay.
Man, those losers.
Hey, buddy. Hey, man, how you doing?
Those losers.
We're here, yes.
Wow.
And it placed me in Ibaraki, which is actually not too far away from Tokyo.
Okay.
But it was in sort of the very countryside of it, up north.
But you got in.
I got in, nice. Yeah. And I did that for 2 years, and there was literally nothing to do there. Obviously, I did work, but like when work was done, you know, the lights go out at like 7,
yeah.
And there's nothing to do. So I'm going to sound super nerdy, and I'm just going to say I stayed in my apartment and just studied and read books in Japanese, and so I just studied like crazy. Because I just wanted it to help me in whatever it was. I didn't want to be a waste being there.
So, like, weekends and stuff? What would you do on weekends?
You know, you'd take the train down to, I think the nearest biggest city was Mito.
Okay. What was a wild night in Mito like?
Eating natto and shopping at Muji or something like that. It's very low-key. Looking back, it wasn't very exciting 2 years. It was more of an educational 2 years.
But you got your Japanese topped off.
Well, I like to think I improved a lot. As I was kind of...
What were you thinking at this time where you're like, you know what? I'm in the fucking middle of nowhere, but I'm going to make my Japanese amazing so that I can... Or, you know, what were you thinking?
Well, I wanted to get a job, you know, like a... Because you can only do JET for so many years. You can't just do it forever.
Right.
So the idea is it would lead to some other job somehow.
Right.
But I also had aspirations of going to graduate school for Japanese literature. Again, pursuing the sort of translation angle.
Sure.
Because when I was in my apartment, again, this super nerdy, I'd find books that I'd read books in Japanese.
Yeah.
And
And
the one I enjoyed.
What kind of fucking nerd is reading books in Japanese?
Yeah.
Jesus.
I know.
What are you doing on this podcast? Nerd. Reading books in Japanese. When are you going to get to the nerdy part? Like, you know, when are you going to get to the nerd
part? Okay, so what I would do is I would translate the entire books.
Okay.
And I would send them to my friends back in the States who also studied Japanese literature but didn't study Japanese.
Mm.
I would say, hey, you should read this book. And I only did it for like one or two. And then,
I'm very interested in people who study Japanese literature without studying Japanese.
Like, that just seems like a rough
thing to do. Like,
well, it seems like if you're really into it, you would naturally, by extension, want to then learn the language.
I'm sure they pick up words, but they don't feel like it's difficult to have
really deep. Like, you could fucking study Japanese literature for like 30 years, and somebody who studied Japanese language for 4 would look at something that you're like big thought out theory on something is like, oh no, actually that word actually doesn't even like that. It's like,
think about everything. Yeah, yeah.
Think about how hardcore you were in university if you really devoted everything to your major, or it was more like a passing interest that you thought was going to help you out.
Oh, okay. So these are people that were just interest in.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, I mean, people take Japanese literature courses or Japanese movie courses because they liked.
Yeah, because like movies and games and stuff, I totally understand that stuff. But it's like literature seems like that's literally like the words that you're getting into. But yeah. But okay, so you'd send it to them and they're like,
yeah, they're like, yeah, thanks. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I read it. But yeah, no, it was fantastic. It was amazing that like,
they totally
yeah.
didn't read it. Mm. But anyway, it's just my thing that I like to do anyway. So.
What were these books you were? Were they like popular fiction?
No, I mean, there was this one book called Go by Kaneshiro Kazuki. It's kind of, it talks about sort of a North Korean sort of national family with the son is born in Japan and goes into the sort of the Zainichi, like the discrimination that's faced with there, but it's kind of like a teen novel. But it was made into a movie that was actually shown in our literature course, so I wanted to...
The movie Go.
Yeah.
That movie...
No, not the Jay Moore.
Not that one.
No, not that one.
All right, got it.
But then at that point, I think Murakami Haruki released Ichikyu Hachion. Mm-hmm. And that didn't get translated for about a year or so. So I would just do chapters and send them over.
Oh, nice. Some of my
what is that called in English? Just 1980?
1Q84.
Oh, 1Q84.
That must have been interesting translating.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because the way it was released, they had book one and two came out, and then it was like, I think, 8 months or something until book three.
Yeah. Right.
So I was reading, I'd read the first two, but it's kind of hard to translate something if you don't know how it ends. So it kind of feels weird that you're... So
we should talk about that also, too, in Japan, how sometimes books are released that way.
Oh, yeah, they're booked in sections, right? So they're never too big.
Most novels are like two books instead of one.
Yeah,
like,
that was three.
People's minds are fucking exploding right now. I think
it's funny because you have to buy it twice.
But that's a really weird fucking thing for people. It's like, wait, what?
It's always been a big Murakami thing too. Where like for Norwegian Wood, he sold it as like the red and green thing for Christmas. It's like you have to buy these two books, and they're set, and it's Christmas. So have fun, guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Although granted, when it's translated, it's not that big of a book that you wouldn't want to separate in English. Although
like you could just to make
well, they usually put them into one. I mean, the proper Norwegian Wood in English is just one book now. But but they did have like a two book version as well.
Yeah.
But
So were you happy at this time? Were you enjoying this?
I was like... kind of like ready to move on, which I guess spurred my. What I did was I applied to a graduate program. It's a language school in Yokohama that I would hopefully go to graduate school afterwards.
Okay. Were you playing video games, by the way?
I mean, actually, no.
Really?
It was very...
What years was this?
Jeez.
Around.
This was 2008, 9, 10 area.
Okay, all right. Okay. Wow.
And it was just before I kind of applied, got into this path that would take me to the game industry, where I finally purchased a PS3. And I know you guys are gonna hate on me for this. I bought it because Final Fantasy 13 was coming out.
Nerd! No, I was gonna say that no matter what you said.
But I'm pretty sure a lot of people did as well. And that then I kind of was at that point. So much of PS3 games had been released, so there was like a dirge of content that I had not seen, and I was.
But you'd played up games through the PS2 era.
Yeah. I think when I went to university, I literally took like 2 or 3 years off playing games, and then my senior year of university, I kind of binged all the PS2 collection.
So you had you played like Resident Evil, Resident Evil 4, like all the survival horror classics at
the
time?
There was
a
huge title that was released. I kind of jumped on it. I do remember specifically kind of pulling out the PS2 for Resident Evil 4.
So you played the PS2 version?
I never GameCube.
Wow. Interesting.
I did get Okami when it came out.
Yep.
That was a big one. At that time, also Shadow of the Colossus.
Mm. Cool.
Yeah.
So then how did you end up at Tango exactly?
Yeah. So I was kind of just settling into, okay, I'm going to go to graduate school, whatever. And I came upon a blog post that was just like, hey, check out the director of Resident Evil's weird application site for his new studio. And I was like, huh. So I clicked on it, and it was just a Flash game, and I don't think it's available now, but
was that the thing with, like, were you cutting off heads or something?
Yeah, you cut off Mikami Shinji's head.
Oh, yeah. That's right, because he said, famously, that Resident Evil 4 will never come out for another system, right? Or
right.
I'll chop my head off.
Yeah, something like that.
I don't know if that was the final causation for this, but it was definitely a weird.
I think it was a joke related to it, because he had, at that time, was just starting up Tango Gameworks, right?
So he left. It didn't have a name at that point,
right? Okay, so it didn't even have a name.
It was because I still have my card when I joined. It was called the Shinji Mikami Project.
Oh, really? Yeah. Oh, very cool.
Was that before or after Vanquish? Do you know?
Was Vanquish had not come out yet?
Yeah, Vanquish he worked on with Platinum, but as like
with seeds, right, or whatever they were called.
Yeah, became
back
clover.
Then. Yeah, or clover. Or, yeah, I can't remember anymore.
No, seeds, I think, became clover, which then became platinum.
Okay.
So yeah, that Vanquish and I want to say there was something else. Well, wait,
Vanquish was the only Mikami game. Mikami didn't work on the other stuff.
No, but. No, no. But I thought he worked on something else at that time. But okay, but so
yeah, so
you saw this weird application.
Yeah, so I did the mini game, and it jumps you to an application page. And it listed all these, open positions, programmers, designers, and things like that. And there was a game designer page. And I just, what struck me was all the sort of points for application was just like, likes games, wants to make games, like passionate about making games and stuff like that. And there was no
checkboxes or what?
No, it was, when you write your requirements for a job. Yeah. And so,
really?
And
there was nothing 5 years
technical
experience.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was like, whoa, huh? I was like, what if I apply to this? Obviously, I grew up playing his games. I was trying to think. I had done no studying about game design. I mean, I played a lot of games besides that. But I wrote a cover letter because this is very weird. I really liked, besides the Resident Evil games and things like that, I liked Ace Attorney games, which he produced. And I just kind of wrote about like how... sort of how varied the work that he's done, and it was kind of like this open thing where it's like, I'm not exactly sure what you're doing at this new thing. I know it involves games, but I want to just be a part of it to make sure that it's the whole world will enjoy it, so it's not just for a very specific audience,
right?
I'm just sort of gasping it, whatever, to try to make it sound like I know what I'm talking about when I'm applying to this job. And surprisingly, they said, oh, you want to come down for an interview? So I went down, and I remember I brought my full translation of that book Go that I talked about.
Oh, you did?
To show that, like, oh yeah, this is what I do. I can translate.
Yeah.
And I remember going to the interview, and I put it down on the table. It's printed out computer paper, so it's like 400 pages or something.
So it's like two or three inches tall.
And he did this thing where he took the corner and he just did like a flip book thing, and he's like, probably checking that it's not just the top page, and he's like. All right, and he just like nods his head.
Yeah,
but I was like, okay, it was worth it, I guess, for that. Because no, but he told me later, he's like, that kind of showed that true about game development.
Something.
Yeah, it's about being really passionate about something that you're willing to invest a lot of time, even if, for example, no one was going to look at it.
Right,
it's that dedication to do something.
Which he's going to prove by also not looking at it.
Right.
That's cool. So the interview went well?
Yeah, I mean, it was...
What was your first impression of him? Like, you knew of him?
I knew of him, but I'd never really sort of gotten to this phase where I was, like, super obsessed with the Japanese game designers.
Yeah.
So I knew his name. I wasn't too familiar with, like, I didn't watch videos of him.
Mm.
I maybe saw a picture in passing or something. I think the picture I remembered was of his sort of the Devil May Cry era where he... had like sunglasses and a little bit of slick backed hair.
Yeah.
But
that's right.
When
he did.
Yeah. But now when I met him, it's pretty much similar to his current state. He's it's very sort of he wears his hat.
He always wears a hat these
always.
Days.
Yeah.
Like
but
it's
very
hat.
Casual in that sense.
Yeah.
And it was very easy to talk to.
Is he losing his hair? Why is he wearing a hat all the time?
No.
Are you sure?
Just a cool style.
Okay. I'm just checking.
I don't know.
So down to earth or like.
Yeah, we just talked about games. I asked him about his projects and stuff like that, and he's like, "Yeah, we need somebody to help out with getting the studio running, as well as just with ideas and stuff like that." So,
okay,
we're looking at a couple people, but we'll get back to you, like
okay.
jobs, And then they, I remember I did this. This is very non-Japanese, but I wrote an email afterwards, being like. You should hire me.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was, like, very aggressive, too, looking
Whoa.
Back.
Whoa. Your follow-up email
yeah,
was,
the
like,
follow-up was, like, yeah,
no,
I am,
seriously.
Like, I'm gonna do a good job and stuff like that. So it was very aggressive.
Must have worked, whatever it was.
And, yeah, and then they said, okay. But
nice.
I was freaking out for a long time because I didn't know anything, and you have lots of people who are...
Did it take a while for them to make the decision? Was it, like, months between
no,
this
no, no,
meeting?
No, it was actually
and...
very, very quick.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
so. Okay, so you're hired, and they tell you immediately, hey... The next game is a horror game.
No, it's like I joined early. This is before.
What number employee were you? Do you know?
It was like 20.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Wow. You really got in early.
This is before Bethesda was involved.
Right.
Oh, right. Yeah.
It was like just at that moment, so it was interesting because it was like a brief, very brief period where it's like it's just us, and then it's like okay, Bethesda's involved.
Right.
Like, I'm like, okay, that's cool.
Yes, for like a fleeting moment, you worked for like an indie Japanese dev, like, which suddenly was no longer indie.
Yeah, but it was nice going into Bethesda. Everyone was like super nice, and they were all interested in kind of learning about us. And I remember very early, like, even the people from it came over, because we used the tech engine, and they were really nice about explaining to us all the stuff we can do
for
with
Evil Within 1
in
the DLC, right?
Yeah, and Evil Within 2.
And Evil Within 2
is based off id Tech.
Okay. Did you guys like make your own branch? I thought it was branded something at the start of the game.
Evil Within 2 is what we call it, the STEM engine.
Yeah.
So it's based off id Tech, but we made like so many adjustments that to fit kind of the art style that we were trying to do and lighting stuff that it kind of became its own.
Why
beast.
Even what is the thinking behind like branding it your own thing? Do you know? Do you have any insight into that thing?
No, we just.
Just want to show off. Like, guys,
it wasn't really
we
like
change the id engine bunch.
I mean, they used numbers to indicate things, but it wasn't even a number at that point. It was like its own thing. So it's like that's what we just kind of wanted to say what it was.
Okay, all right. So, but early on, you know that there's going to be a like the Within, aka Psycho Break in Japan, is going to be the game that you're.
Well, like there was some obviously some concepts being thrown out in the beginning, but we kind of settled on this this sort of return to survival horror idea.
Cool.
You know, at this point, remember, I'm, like, super new to this company, so I'm not there, like, making these decisions.
Of course.
I'm just, like, being excited when we make a decision, we're going back to survival horror, and I'm like, oh, man, this is going to be so cool.
Right. But, yeah, was there also not a feeling of, like, pressure, where it's like, hey, everyone is going to expect this to be, you know, his last game in survival horror was Resident Evil 4. So you got to be better than that. One of the like greatest, widely acknowledged as one of the greatest games of all time.
I mean, maybe some of the other people can tell a different story. Like I said, I'm like I was super new at this point, so I was just like, more.
Hey guys, what's going on?
Yeah, I was like, this is super cool. We're gonna do this. Maybe they were all just like, how are we gonna top that?
Yeah,
but I'm like, yeah, let's do something really cool. It's gonna be fun.
So what was your job? What were you doing on Evil Within 1?
My job
the main game
is,
vanilla
yeah is one. Game designer
right
and it's kind of like a vague
planner
term.
In Japanese
planner kikaku but it encompasses doing sort of just planning the entire game, whether it's like you know concepts or gameplay elements, as well as doing level design and physically going into the engine and making things.
So you're like so gray boxing, like, you're like moving a desk, you're doing everything from like, hey, I think we should have a level, just to throw out an example, like, hey, there should be a level in a mansion or a cave or a city. Everything from saying that, from making those kind of level.
Yeah, I mean,
of
if I was like, hey, I thought of a cool place for this level to be in, you know, and you pitch it and you get an okay, or, you know, I need a new enemy in the stage because I'm getting tired of finding this one. But do you have any designs or can I talk to the character people? Yeah, let's talk to them.
Oh, and then, okay.
You know, it's a weird sort of position where you have to have ideas, but you also have to be able to act on them and manage people and manage expectations and make sure it's going to spec, and then adjusting it if it's not going to spec or it's not good.
And you have to take ideas from other people as well, right? I'm sure there was a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, the player needs to... I mean, I don't know what kind of guidelines they would give you, but like, were there levels where just, okay, here's the level... make it interesting, you know, place the enemies and the power-ups and make a puzzle. And
yeah, I mean, like a good example is like one of the levels I was in charge of was the mansion level in the first game.
One of the best.
Oh, thank you.
One of the best parts of that game. was that a conscious throwback to the Resident Evil mansion? Because like it was widely acknowledged as
felt like it.
Yeah, as like, I mean, not a homage, but like spiritually, I don't know how you would
maybe this comes from sort of the team's excitement to go back into survival horror. I think it was almost like subconscious where it's like, let's bring back these locations, but it wasn't like, hey, this is the Resident Evil,
this is the Spencer Mansion or whatever.
And actually we specifically took out some things that we thought were maybe too on the nose about that. But maybe, like we had a level where it's like, you're in the mansion and you're going to explore it to find like details about like the antagonist's past, and then
the family,
the Victoriano family.
Victoriano,
so Ruvik's
family. I couldn't remember his last name.
But then, for example, we have a level where there's enemies in there, and you're going back and forth. But then it's kind of a little bit bland. So I would go like, "Hey, can we do these? What about this puzzle where you're like sort of going through his lobotomy experiments to sort of dive deeper into him?" And then, that's a good idea. Let's try it out.
So you would come up with the puzzle that would also have story aspects to it, and Yeah, everything. You have to think holistically about...
I guess that's my sort of thing. I try to tie in everything.
Right.
So it's not just a puzzle. It's not just like a you know...
Right. Puzzle for puzzle's sake.
Yeah. It tries to like match with some sort of story element. We knew that that was a stage that was going to have a lot of story stuff in it, so I wanted to make it like a little bit more meaningful.
Are you not a fan of the, like, you know, the old Resident Evil trope where it's like, okay, wait, why in the original design of this mansion was putting a shotgun on the wall a trigger to opening like a trap door to anywhere, or why is there a medallion here? Like, what do you, did you try to ground your puzzles, or are you okay with that as a conceit?
I think
if it's fun, fuck it, who cares?
I think there's a level to it. Like, if for stuff like that, even now, I don't really think of it as that's a big a deal, because the whole point was that was a mansion with lots of weird stuff in it, and you were gonna see what was gonna come next. It was like that sort of Winchester type mansion. But I guess, like I said, for the mansion level, you knew it was going to be about story. Mm-hmm. It's like, how can we sort of get that as deeper, involving as possible to the player? So that was kind of the point. And even that level had kind of one of those weird ones where it's, I think there was like, you collected two safe dials and looked at a picture to get the amount of people in there. And that was kind of that was maybe a little bit of a throwback to the old type of puzzles where it's like, who has this in their house?
But, right, yeah.
But I don't know. I remember the lobotomy experiment one was that more...
like the whole game. I was like terrified of that level, probably because you knew he was around like somewhere, but you didn't know where he was. Mm-hmm. And so like, you just like, wherever you go in the house, you're kind of like constantly on your toes.
There, so I think it was the, it was the mansion level. One of the, like, things to this day that I don't know if I've seen a definitive answer to, right when you come in, is it at night and it's dark and foggy when you're in the outside of the mansion the first time? If you zoom up into one of the windows, there's a dude there, and no one knows who that dude is. Who's that dude? What's he doing there?
I'm not going to give you an answer to that. That's
really?
That's the biggest secret. No.
Seriously?
I don't know. Just take it for what it is.
No. What, that's what I don't know what the hell it is. How can I take it for what it is?
It's a guy in a window.
It's not Leslie, right?
It's not Leslie.
It's not Leslie. Okay.
No. Do you know who it is, or is it just random?
I want to keep the mystery alive.
I mean, it seems so weird because it's like so... 99% of people will never find that thing.
But there's a lot of stuff in that game that I don't know if everyone found everything, but there was a lot like weird,
really?
Like triggered stuff. And so,
speaking of, there's some like the crows thing. I didn't know about this until after I finished the game. But in the first, like the which seemed like a throwback to RE4, but that like village level. I don't know, what did you call that level? The level with all
we
of
called
the,
it the village. Yeah,
we called it the village. Okay, that level, like, if you do some stuff, it triggers a thing where you have to kill 5 crows in 2 minutes. And if you do it, 5 very specific just crows throughout the level, if you do it, you get like 100,000 things of gel or something. What else was in there? What else were the super weird, like, little things?
I don't know now. No,
really?
You're putting me on the spot.
Okay, let's just talk about the guy in the window in the mansion.
No.
But that's a story significant thing, right? That's not just a throwaway, like, oh, this would be a funny, like, hey, it's the planner's, lead planner's dad or something like that, right? That's actually, like, story-relevant detail.
I find it way more entertaining to sort of see you floundering about this, but I don't think I'm going to give you an answer.
Oh, man, how long has it been? What the fuck? Come on, you don't even give that? I mean, it seems like DLC 1 and 2, which you also worked on, we're all about that. Like, okay, here's answering, like, here's like pulling everything together, answering unanswered questions, making things that maybe didn't make sense or didn't seem like they made sense kind of make sense and stuff like that.
Well, I think it's safe to say that the story for the first Evil Within didn't make a lot of sense, and I think that was one of the things that the DLC helped a lot, right? It helped pull together these weird threads of things that were like, what just happened, you know? And like, the DLC's point seemed to me to kind of make it make sense of it all. But is that not what you were going into when you made the DLC? Like-
no, that was a little bit of the intention. It's not that there was lots of hints there, but we knew it was like super well hidden.
Yeah.
And
like the guy in the window at the fucking start of the mansion. Did you have to like zoom in with a sniper scope to see before he walks away?
Mark's never gonna let you live this down.
I'm not gonna answer this. But so we knew that there was a lot of stuff that people would kind of want direct answers to. And then there was the Kidman character, who is, you know, absent for a majority of the game, and didn't really have those hints in there of what she was doing. So to me, that kind of stuck out, and I thought that there was kind of an interesting story to tell in there.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a story that was written when the original game was being made.
Right.
As we were sort of nearing the end, we knew that it was kind of maybe a little bit of a hole that kind of was asking to be filled.
Right.
Even by people on the design team, they were like, oh, I wonder what she was doing.
Mm-hmm. You
know? Huh. And so I remember I pitched an idea to focus. We knew we were going to work on some DLCs for the first game,
mm-hmm.
To make a sort of a season pass. And I pitched an idea, story DLC for kind of explaining what Kidman was doing.
Mm. You had the whole, here's what she was doing, da da da, or just the idea, hey, as the DLC, let's make it what she
was
doing.
Yeah, I remember the story was like very vague. It, from a gameplay perspective, it was kind of there. It was intended to be sort of a less gun-heavy, maybe a little bit more edging on the horror.
Yeah.
You know, because the way we determined survival horror was sort of having that ability to fight back, but we'd put in some enemies that you couldn't fight back in and see how that plays. You know, just to...
You had to run or you had to hide from enemies.
And as an experiment for us, too, you know, we wanted to try different things.
Right.
And then it kind of tied into... I tried to see if we can work that story-wise. You know, it's a... How can we make a character who's maybe not like, you know, Sebastian was in the main game, it's kind of like gung-ho, just shooting everything, but a little bit more vulnerable, and then tie that all together.
Mm-hmm.
And so I kind of pitched it from a gameplay perspective, and Mikami-san was kind of like, oh, that's cool. So why don't you, like, try fleshing it out, like, writing out the story stuff. And then I did that, and then I kind of brought it back, and then at that point, you know, all the story stuff was there, and the gameplay stuff was there, and he's like, well, you might as well just like direct it, I guess, because you kind of you know what you want it to be.
Really?
So
that's awesome.
Were you expecting that at all? Were you thinking if he likes this, I will maybe?
No, I kind of maybe imagined that he would let me kind of do the heavy design work and maybe write the script or something advise the script. But I was a little bit surprised by that. But I was like,
oh, that's huge. That's crazy. I mean, like, you'd been in the game industry for some total of how many years by that point?
Maybe it wasn't even four? 3 years or something like that. I don't know. You know, looking back, you know, I'm super, super thankful because it was like obviously a very risky move in a sense.
It's a huge vote of confidence.
Yeah.
But you'd worked your butt off up until that point.
It's all because you sent that email. That second email.
Maybe, yeah, that's right. That first email.
You sent him another email saying, hey, you should really fucking let me do this DLC.
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe it was the mansion stage. I don't know.
Maybe it was mansion. Yeah. What are the other parts of Evil Within 1 that you worked on?
It was actually a sort of a bookend thing. I did the mansion stage and the one after that, which some people kind of
which one was
unfondly
the one after
remember.
That?
It's like it's a very hard stage. It's kind of like this dungeon with this
with the
sort
spider
of spinning
girl?
Blade. Yeah, there's a second fight against Laura, and then it ends after that another boss fight.
Yeah.
So it was kind of meant to be this like hard climax of the game.
Is that the level
that
where you're constantly doing the valves, turning the valves?
You're
or
shooting valves to stop flames or move flames.
Yeah. I remember that level very clearly.
It was kind of meant to be this sort of this difficulty climax that you would kind of face as you go into the sort of the conclusion of the game.
There's still a bunch more game after that. Like the final third of the game or something almost, right?
Yeah.
I would argue it gets a lot harder after that. Like some of the stuff in that city stage where there's a lot of where were the guys who blow themselves up or something? There's a lot of like potential one-hit deaths.
Well, that was a lot of the first game in general.
Right. Yeah. So what was the feedback that you got going into DLC 1? Did you have the feedback from the first game to look at, or did you have to start all that DLC stuff before the game was out?
No, I mean, by the time the original game came out, we were pretty much into the dev period of the DLC. So we weren't responding.
So you couldn't react to it was already
like
too
that.
Late to react to feedback from the game itself?
I wouldn't say it was too late because we knew it was a little bit, the gameplay was a little bit different. So even if we were reacting to feedback,
it's kind of a different game.
You know, internally too, we were kind of like, I was freaking out the whole time, right? Because, it's my first time doing that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But, we're a little cautious because it involves a lot of stealth gameplay. And, we weren't sure exactly. There's a lot of gameplay in the first game, lots of different, like,
styles
that you can go through. And we weren't sure kind of like which ones are going to maybe hit the most with the audience. Because there are situations where you can't fight back as well.
Right.
Some people may like the gunplay. Some people may like that horror element. Some people may not care for the story.
It's almost not scripted scenes, but like parts where you're just running from a like super powerful thing. There's parts where you're trying to sneak past a really powerful enemy. There's parts where you could do stealth or you could do non-stealth. There's kind of open worldy parts of the game. There's more puzzly parts of the game.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a ton of different smorgasbord, if you will.
Yeah. So again,
did you have a feeling? Did you have an inkling of like, I think this one's going to be popular. I don't think this one is. And then how did that go against what you judged as the reaction?
To me, it was more about like if people felt that it was not just like retreading ground. It was something new, as well as sort of making. I think the ultimate goal was I wanted it to feel like a package, like almost like I play the DLCs now. I like the original better. It makes sense,
right,
or something like that. So right. Actually, as a set, they would increase the entire value of the series of what we made it to that point. I didn't want it to think of like I don't like the first game, so
right.
I like this,
but I like this.
Yeah. So it was really kind of meant to be a set, so we were kind of, I was a little bit worried that people who really, really liked the shooting gameplay would jump back and be like, I don't want this.
Right.
And at the end, while we did have some opinions on like that, a majority of the response that we got was actually very, very positive to it.
Right. I think a lot of people are just so happy to have answers and have things make sense to them in the story, right? Like a lot of people, like you were talking about now, liked the game better for having known, oh, okay, this is why, you know, this person did that, or this is why this person acted that way. Whereas before, you might have either assumed you didn't know, or you might have assumed that just there was no answer for it. Like, there was no good answer for it in the fiction.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, internally, we were sort of satisfied. I know going into it, as we were kind of putting it out, I felt pretty strongly that it kind of hit the targets that we wanted to hit, which is I wanted to get a little bit more stronger into the sort of the story and gameplay interconnected stuff. And I was pushing that. And for me, that was a little bit of a test case. Like, I wanted to kind of show that it's a valid way to approach stuff like this.
Yeah.
The response was good. And internally, everyone was pretty happy with what we were able to do with it. So
cool.
That was cool.
So then the decision gets made to do Evil Within 2, and then is it just when do you get tapped to be director on that then? Was it from the start? It's like, well, you did good on the DLCs, so here's the keys.
Yeah, well, I was sort of taken into a room kind of early on. You know, we kind of, when we knew we were going to do sequel stuff, we kind of settled on, oh, let's do, you know, Sebastian and stuff, and then I was kind of taken into a room, and it's like, you do it, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
And was that like, you know, was there any like, I mean, obviously they must have felt satisfied with the work you did before for them to even approach you, but was there any like, hey, you did a good job, so we want you to keep doing it? Or was it like, well, we're looking for this angle and you were good at this angle, so you do it? Or like, what was the sort of, because you must have felt like a lot of pressure from getting picked to be the director of the full game now. Like, I know DLC directing is not an easy task, but this is a big difference. Taking on AAA sequel to a big game as the guy in charge. Like, what was the approach from them to you?
We didn't really go into depth. I like to think maybe it was because the DLC went all right. So
right, but it
like
was,
the reactions were positive.
Literally just, hey, you do it.
That's
amazing. And what was your reaction?
I was like,
did you expect it at all?
I was like, okay.
Did you think it was a possibility?
I wanted to do something like that at some point, so I was kind of like, okay.
So you were gung-ho from the
yes,
you knew and had to know it's going to be an amazing amount of work.
Yeah, it was kind of one of those things that after that I was a little bit freaking out, and I was like, oh my god,
what did I sign myself up for?
But most of these things, it's majority of it is like the excitement for what you can do with something and what you're going to make with it. You know, there's so many options to take it and what to do with what. So there's a ton of stuff, new stuff you need to think about. And it was a little bit of like, okay, this is cool, so I'm just going to do this for the next, you know, a very long time, and I'm not going to do anything else.
Yeah, as Mark and I both, people who, like, you know, occasionally drink with you and hang out with you, it was funny, because, like, yeah, for a while there, you had just disappeared from the face of the earth. It was, like, I still remember the night, there was, like, one night we all got together, and you had this, like, grim look on your face, and then we just didn't see you, and I found out much later, like, that was, like, the day you found out you were going to be directing the game, and it was like, oh, okay, and we hadn't seen you.
Not just, like, weekday nights and stuff, but, like weekends,
all holidays, weekends.
So what was that like, and how did it match up with your expectations overall, just being a director within a Japanese studio?
I don't know. It's hard to say if you have expectations, because I mean,
are you in meetings all day and making yes-no decisions all day?
We do have a lot of meetings, obviously, but I kind of tried to model it, because I'm working with Mikami-san on this project. You know, he's executive producer on it, so it's kind of like a team effort.
Of course.
And making sure that, obviously, there's some things that need to be learned. But I kind of modeled it after how he worked with us on the original game, he was, like, there. You know, he doesn't have his own office. He's sitting... I mean, I was sitting next to him for a good year and a half.
Mm. Oh, wow.
On the first game. You know, and he's moving desks around, and he's, like... We say, you know, he's in the Gemba, right? So he's there at the scene, you know, playing it, fine-crafting it, talking to people, deciding stuff with people who are working on it. Mm. And I was like, and that's kind of what I did for the DLC as well. I tried to be as involved as possible, talking with people of ideas, asking what they would think. And I did the same thing for the sequel. I tried to be very involved in there.
So are people coming up with, and you're okaying everything at every phase before it goes in, or is there a lot of stuff just going in, and then you're like, you know, the chef that just swings by and tastes the soup every once in a while is like, okay, no, it's got to be more, you know, this way? Or, like, how granular did you get, or were there certain things that you got really detailed on, certain things you had to leave up to other people? Or
yeah, I think when you're doing a project like this, the DLC was small scale, so it's very easy to get involved in almost every aspect.
Right.
With this one, I learned you have to really sort of trust your team and give a lot of the aspects to the team.
Delegate.
Yeah, and then sort of let it filter back, and you have to trust them to make decisions of quality as well.
Right.
Which is, you know, a very important leadership role.
Right.
And then, but at the end, it needs to come back to you, and you need to make sure that the quality is there as well.
Right. Yeah. So was that hard to do? I mean, was that...
I'm not going to say, oh, yeah, it was super easy. Yeah.
Right.
No, obviously, there's a learning curve, and there's bumps on the road, but, right. You know, we got it done, so...
Did you feel like there were, like, a lot of times where, like, you had to, like, you know, just go, like, run almost, like, running, crying into the Mikami's room, like, help me, master, you know, or, like...
No, because we were talking a lot, and I'd be like, oh my God, I don't know what to do with this. And he's like, you know, he'd give you your advice and we talk it through and stuff like that. So, like I said, it's not just you're there and everyone's waiting. It's a very communicative process.
Sure.
I think a lot of people, when they think of game development, they think of it's very top down. And maybe that's how it is with some people.
Right.
In all my experience, it's a very team-based project.
Right.
So, in a way, I do think it's also kind of unfair for some people to get, like, complete credit on things when
right.
so many decisions are made by so many people, and it's
sure.
a collaborative effort.
Yeah, and part of it is you just have to designate somebody that's going to
yeah,
be
to get the blunt.
Yeah, well, and also just to do interviews and to do stuff
what
like
is it
that.
It's I love this. I watch a lot of, like, director's commentary, and I love David Fincher, and he talks about I think he was talking about Alien 3, where he had a bad experience with that, right?
Yeah.
And he's like, I think
his first major motion picture, I think.
Yes. And
oh, really?
He was, like,
he'd done music videos
terrible,
up until then.
But he was like, I think if the movie gets a bad rap, then the director gets too much credit. But if the movie's great, it gets
the other way. Around?
Yeah, it's the other way. No, it's in general like the. it's hilarious that I can't remember the line that inspired me. But yeah. So anyway, I think it was emphasizing the fact of it's a team effort that most people...
Sure.
Please edit this out. This is a very embarrassing
Okay, well, on that note, so let's talk about... Now let's get into the Evil Within 2 stuff. So, like, from the start, like, what are the marching orders for Evil Within 2? What are, like, the pillars or the mission statement? Or what is the, like... Okay, Evil Within 1 was more like this. With Evil Within 2, we're going to do... this, like, what is the mantra that you kept returning to in terms of you know, the overall mission with this game, what it was going
to
be.
So it's tricky. We knew from the beginning we wanted it to be about Sebastian. Like, we liked Sebastian, but we didn't feel like he really got a good sort of story out of the first one. Mm. So we wanted to kind of bring him back. And one of the key things from the beginning was, like, story of redemption. Let's sort of show the type of character that Sebastian is and what he's going to take to overcome some difficulty that's going to be.
Right.
And then...
You didn't feel like he got redeemed in The Evil Within 1.
I don't... You know, he survived.
Yeah.
Whether or not it's being redeemed or not is a separate issue.
Okay. Interesting.
But I think there was just kind of stories to tell there.
Yeah.
So we wanted to come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
And from a gameplay perspective, kind of one of the things we landed on early on was, which was actually one of the original concepts of the first game, was these sort of open stages.
Mm.
We tried it in the first game, and it didn't go as smooth as we anticipated, so we wound up making them smaller. I think, for example, the village chapter.
The village is probably the biggest example.
Yeah, or the mansion, too, was kind of a little bit open. Like, yeah, you know, free exploration was a point. And... internally, we still wanted to, you know, try that again. We thought that we didn't get to do it the first time as big or the scale that we wanted to. And we wanted to come back to that. And personally, I thought that I wanted to go back to kind of what I remember survival horror about, which was about exploration.
Right.
Even like the original Resident Evil Mansion, while it was small, you kind of just...
It didn't seem small at the time.
Looking, like, if you play now, you're like, whoa, this is...
Oh, yeah, yeah. You're like, oh, I can run through this.
But at the time, it was... Completely. It felt like weeks you were trapped in there.
Yeah.
Or, like, the original Silent Hill and things like that, where you were exploring the town, and just, even if there wasn't that much there, you were kind of... You felt like you were there.
You had that feeling. Yeah, that's interesting.
And that's just kind of... I was like, that feeling. Like, let's see if we can bring that back.
And no matches.
Yeah, that didn't...
You're like, fuck the matches. Get rid of the matches. The burning the bodies.
Oh, yeah, the matches are gone.
That was a whole huge major mechanic with the first game.
I know it was on the table for a while, but we just couldn't figure out a way to get it in. Spoilers for people who played it. Like, the later half of the game has fire enemies, so...
Right.
It was kind of like... It was a little bit going against that.
You
need ice matches.
But, yeah, it we didn't... We wanted... Like I said, the first game also had lots and lots of things in it, but we wanted to focus on maybe... get better on maybe fewer things and make that work better.
But you wanted to keep the stealth? Was this something you said you wanted to keep? Like, the upgrade system? Like, a lot of the stuff seems like preserved from the first game.
We still wanted to kind of make it feel like what The Evil Within was, but, you know, even internally, for some people, the game was different for everybody. What was it about? It was like a shoot 'em up, or it was a stealth game. That was a stealth game that was, maybe the stealth was underutilized, or it was like a game that the story doesn't make sense or something. I don't know.
Right.
Or it was about Sebastian. So there's lots of things. And if we knew we were coming back to Sebastian, in my mind, I just wanted to... I didn't want to sort of betray those gameplay elements, the core gameplay elements that we had. And from the beginning, the original game was about sort of shooting and stealth.
Right.
And so I still thought that was sort of an area that we can make better, we can use, and was also sort of a gameplay element that opened itself up to a lot of options for players. And if we were going to branch out into these bigger levels where we wanted people to explore and try different things, having that gameplay element be about making decisions like that, I thought was important.
Were there any criticisms you took from the first game or the two DLCs really to heart, and you're like, okay, with this game... If there's anything I'm going to address, it's at least going to be that, and we're going to do that differently this time for sure.
The black bars.
The black bars.
A lot of people did that.
Letterboxing.
Yeah, there was a patch to remove the black bars. I still stand by what I've said previously, that I think from a design's vision, it looks really cool.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that probably people didn't appreciate how it affected sort of the
gameplay.
Image quality or gameplay.
Right. Walking down a ladder or something, just like the practicality of it or not.
That's why we included it as like sort of a bonus thing in the main The Evil Within 2.
That's right.
When you beat it.
Nice.
Which I do think the game looks super cool if you play with black bars.
So, so you're still a black bar believer.
I just think...
Would you play it yourself cool. with the black bars?
Well, that's the thing, because we...
When you
work on it for so long, I was so used to it that, and I think we were all so used to it. And we didn't get that much feedback about that. So we were a little bit taken aback because, again, we just thought it looked cool. We added to the style. But then we were like, oh, no. To us, it wasn't that important that it was worth risking everything. But we just, it was an aesthetic choice that we thought was...
What about difficulty-wise? Was there any strong takeaway from the first game? Or was it just like, let's do the different tier difficulties again?
Well, what we had multiple difficulties in the first game.
Right.
But kind of at the end, again, this is because we played the game for so long that we thought it wasn't too difficult.
Right.
But it turns out that even the easiest difficulty was extremely difficult for some people.
Right.
And that wasn't
the amount
intention.
Of ammo and stuff like that, I think, was a lot something with the game. Especially in the early part of the game when you're still adjusting to the controls and stuff, I think. I mean, and some people, that's the sort of thing, some people really, I think, love the game for that reason.
Yeah, the high difficulty. And so that was another thing where it was
just that it doesn't turn
people.
Into a just a massive shooting game at the start because you literally just don't even have that many bullets.
Yeah, so that was a big point from the beginning this time was we wanted to balance the difficulties better. We wanted to have a difficulty because we knew that story was going to be a bigger focus and we wanted people to see it to the end. Because we felt very strongly about the sort of the resolution, the ending to the game. So we're like, oh, this is super cool. We want
it's
them
a shame
to see,
if people don't get to see the whole story. What was the hardest... Oh, sorry. Did you want to say something? What was the hardest difficulty in the first game? Akumu.
Everything killed you in one hit.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which is amazing. And so, did you guys have to test that internally?
I was actually the one who had to test that.
Really? So did you finish the first game on that mode?
And I finished it in, like, its debug phase when it was, like, three times harder than it was.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, this is the guy who has how many platinum trophies?
Not anymore.
Oh, yeah. We should have talked about that with your background, that you had a thing for a time where you would not play any game unless you would just platinum every single game that you played. And that stood for a while,
How many platinums did you get on that account?
No, I ended it at 100. So.
Jeez. 100 platinums.
It's amazing that you got to 100.
And that's all you had on that account, right? It was every game on the account was platinum.
Yeah.
There was not a single game on there that didn't have a platinum.
What was the worst? What was the lowest point where you're like, fuck, I can't believe I did this. Now I have to play X game. Do you have one answer?
The most difficult ones, I remember this. Actually, Vanquish. Because I remember, actually, this is funny, going to work and complaining to Yamazan about how difficult the platinum was. I was like, did you do it? And he was like, no.
Didn't you do something weird for like some Uncharted game where like you like played like a, you played something with
something.
Second 2 players?
No, I bought another PS3 to
play multiplayer with yourself.
Dude, that's where you got to check yourself.
I don't know. And
that's what kind of what caused you. You have a problem.
Gave up the trophy.
And this was also this is pre DLC days, so like I maybe had a little bit more time. So luckily, I think that was a turning point where I was like, I don't know if I can really do this anymore.
Before you were directing the DLCs. Yeah, that's a good thing that you gave that up. But is there a crazy difficulty level?
There
like
is.
That
it's
in
it's called classic mode.
Yeah, but it's not.
It's not one kill.
Hit,
it's,
right.
It's. I guess even for the DLC, we had its own hard difficulty, which was Kuriyami, which means darkness in Japanese. And to me, I guess these harder difficulties played off the mechanics of the core game. So Within was very hardcore. It felt like everything was killing you in one hit. Well, here's the mode that kills you in one hit, right?
Right.
The DLCs were about sort of this light and dark mechanic using your flashlight. So what about a mode where that's the only light source you have?
Right.
And then the gameplay, like I said, from my perspective, it was kind of a throwback to the old exploration, the feeling that we would get from the old games, which had things like limited saves and things like that.
Right,
so
what
if we do like a throwback to that, a mode with limited saves, you can't level up your character and stuff like that as plays off it as well, because it's not a stage-based game. It's you have to play through the whole thing
right.
in sequence. So I just thought that worked well with that philosophy.
So now this is going to turn into a lot of just real random questions. Some are going to be very big and vague, and some are going to be very like super specific. So I just want to like prepare you for that kind of eventuality.
Speed round.
I may not have every answer. I'm sorry.
Evidenced by the first question, which is, this is a general video game development question. Why are things like cups and bottles so big in video games? Like, they're so much bigger than they're not to scale. Like when somebody picks up a cup, or there's like a cup sitting on a table, right? and you go up to it, it's like obviously way bigger.
Are these listener questioners or are these Mark McDonald questions?
These are both. Don't worry about it.
Minor questions.
Why is that the case? Strange question. Do you have an answer for that?
I have a better question. Why are you so concerned with this stuff?
Dude, I told you there was going to be very specific questions.
Okay.
Why not?
I guess the simple answer is just so you can see it. It's easier to see.
So, like, did you not think about that when you made the game? Like, what the fuck? This bottle is huge, but I guess it has to be that big to read in the game.
I've seen some comments about the game. I don't think anyone's commented on how big the bottle is.
Somebody has commented on that.
Right now they have.
Yes. Okay. You didn't notice.
Next question. Sure
you didn't notice.
If you go through many games, the doors are too big. There's stuff like that. So
right. Yeah, I guess that's true. There's a line in it about like blood. Hope it's not so and so's blood. Was that an intentional throwback?
That was in there. I don't think that's in there.
I think that's in there. Yeah.
You should cross that out.
No, I'm crossing that out because I asked it. But like you don't even know that that's a. All right, that's in your own thing. What about the Scientology kind of subtext to the recruiting going on in the, I forget what it's called, like Father Theodore, the second boss in the game, has his like recruitment centers that are basically like Scientology stuff. Probably, are you worried about getting like Tom Cruise on your case? You're like making faces like you don't know what I'm talking about.
But I mean, like, I don't think we ever talked about, is that a reference to any specific religion? It's probably a better question for the writer of the script. But you know, the Theodore character is supposed to be very religious, so there is probably inspiration taken from many sources.
Very, very diplomatic.
I'm being very diplomatic.
Very diplomatic answer there.
Because I don't have a good one. Besides, no.
I don't know. I don't believe that for a second. It super obviously definitely is. What about, like, puzzle design and stuff like that? Did you leave that up to other, like, the stuff that you were doing in the first game, now that you're directing the second game, did you leave all that stuff up to other people and you're just like shaping what they're bringing in, or did you contribute a lot of just whole ideas on your own, similar to like what you had did on the first game?
Probably like most game development stuff, it's both. Mm-hmm. You've maybe come from like, hey, from a pacing issue, it would be cool if we can maybe have some sort of puzzle thing here, and then I leave it up to somebody to come up with an idea. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody has an idea for what they make, and then it's good. Or maybe I thought of something, and I was like, oh, this would be good here.
What are some examples? Was something from the game that you're especially like happy with or proud of that you had come up with?
I don't know.
A level or a puzzle or an enemy or anything?
I don't know. I like to keep it vague so it doesn't feel like, oh, that was made by that guy or something.
I see. Even though you made the fucking mansion level in the first game.
I'm only saying that because I was
publicized. Taking credit for that.
That's open information.
What determines like how much gel things drop? It seems random to a degree.
No, there's...
Do you know?
We have a nice spreadsheet, and there's a theory to all of it.
Really?
Not that I could probably explain here.
But it's... Okay.
But there
it's
is...
There's a logic.
There's a logic to it. It's not random. It's not RNG.
No.
Really?
I mean, there's random elements to it, but obviously...
That's what I mean. Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Like speaking of random, like, notice... I did one sequence and got killed by like a guy zombie, went back and did the same thing, and it was like a girl zombie that leaped out at the same part in the game. So how much randomness is there to the enemies and where they appear and what's going on with them? Like what's the deal with that kind of system?
I probably, you know, this is like a technical thing, but like models and stuff, well, there's a possibility that they're randomly generated. Obviously all the enemies are they're set. So we place our enemies there by hand.
Right.
So
where there is an enemy is set, but what the model that enemy takes
certain
within
ones
a
are,
certain class.
Certain ones are very specific.
Right.
But, you know, there's a lot of enemies in the game. And
how many?
Yeah. I don't know. Oh, really? You mean like number of placed enemies?
No, there's like how many different enemies are there? So that's what you were going to say,
enemy
right?
types?
No, I was going to say like placed enemies.
Oh, okay. So you guys...
But even the first game was like that. It was different enemies in different situations.
Totally. What about inspirations from the game? So, like, a lot of people, especially in the early on in the game, a lot of people point to, like, PT, for example. You keep redoing this, like, not the same hallway, but almost kind of like the same hallway, similar hallway. Twin Peaks is another thing a lot of people pointed to, with, like, the curtains and stuff like that. Any inspirations that you want to talk about that you took into the game?
I've said this before, but maybe probably one of the visual inspirations for the game was based on this movie, The Cell. Maybe you've seen it. It's the early 2000 film.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Jennifer Lopez. It's a similar premise, too. They dive into the mind of
what's his name? The actor, Vincent D'Onofrio?
Yes.
Yeah.
And he has this very warped mind. They're trying to figure out like where he's hidden.
There's that chopped up horse, that like vivisection horse.
That's a cool scene
from that movie. Yeah. But, interesting. So that kind of the
surrealness, I think, was the original game. Like maybe a keyword was sort of gore, or blood and things like that. And the like surreal elements was definitely something you wanted to touch upon in the sequel.
Mm. So kind of the, what's the, was Valentini, is that the name of
the... Stefano.
Yes.
Yeah.
The slow-mo artwork thing with the music and stuff like that. Where did the, I guess, thoughts behind that come? Like, how do you guys set about making the villain? I mean, I guess there's kind of three villains in this game.
Yeah, it's like super spoiler territory.
Well, this is all spoiler territory. Let's just get that out of the way. I mean, it should be obvious by now, but yeah, we're going to spoil the shit out of everything. So,
yeah, you know, we wanted to have these multiple villains. It was kind of an early concept. And so we can sort of...
Instead of just one from the first game.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And we knew that since it was a personal story, there has to be one that's directly related to the character, which is the final one, Myra.
Right.
And then the early on features was like, how can we take this concept, you know, inside the mind, what people can do when they have their control over it and mess with it? And that concept of sort of an artist who like loves the beauty of death came up very early with the image of maybe he would kill people and leave their bodies frozen and things like that. And it was something that was not possible in the real world, obviously. But we were saying that this would be a super cool visual. And then you have one character who's this, it's external, right? So Stefano's all about imagery and what you see. And then we'd have another character that would be the opposite. It would be this internal thing. So Theodore is more about, he doesn't directly do things. He influences you. He knows like what you fear, like your faults, and he'll bring those out. So it's less a direct thing and more an indirect thing, while Stefano is coming at you with knives and things like that and creatures.
Right.
And Theodore would just torture you with other things. And there was also a visual difference. Obviously, you have the blue hinge with Stefano stuff. And then the white with Myra. The original game had lots of stages that you were jumping between. And we wanted to do that as well. But we wanted to keep sort of maybe a little bit of logic to that this time and say, like, oh, this is because of this person or this person.
And
drive that line through the game.
Right. What about, so, like, obviously the open world ish parts were a big thing in this game, right? Like, did that come online late? Did you identify early, like, oh, this is going to be a big new kind of differentiator for this, like, more so than I think has ever been in any kind of horror game or survival horror game? I feel like you guys pushed that aspect, but it happens kind of in the middle, and then it goes into a more guided experience, I think, because there's like a chapter early on, is, I don't know if it's like chapter 3 or something, that's just like boom, and it lasts for a really long time because it's, or it could, if you want to do everything, and then it goes down into some more focus stages that go more like a normal video game. But
Like I said early on, we wanted to try to tackle these open levels,
right?
And I think the biggest challenge, and it was very challenging, was just to get it to work. We knew that we wanted it to be sort of a pacemaker. You know, when you make something like horror, it's not just about just throwing scary stuff at you, and it's more about pacing. Like, you have highs and lows. We wanted this sort of open area to be about, it's weird to say it's a low point, but from a tension level, there'd still be tension there because you're scrapped on supplies. You don't know when something's going to come out.
Right.
But you're not in this tight, compact area where it's constantly being oppressive to you. You have like a feeling of like, if I have to run, I can run, but there's still risk. And we wanted to use that as more of a pace control.
Get on a ladder and just stay on a ladder because no enemies
can
attack you on a ladder. Did you know about this? Ladder is freedom. It's like Switzerland of Evil Within 2. Enemies cannot attack you while you're on a ladder. They can climb up and down ladders, which surprised me. That's cool.
I think you take damage when they climb down.
What's that?
You take damage.
No, but they won't attack you, and they'll just walk. They'll just take a ladder.
Now I know how you play games. I think you just
you don't know about the bottle sizes. You didn't know about the bottle sizes and cup sizes, and now you didn't know about the ladder.
I think Mark might have played your game a little too much.
Huh? No, but go ahead.
I don't even remember what I was thinking.
You were talking about the open world parts and how it's challenging, the highs and lows, and that was a low.
Yeah, and it was a low from the sort of the tension or the oppressive atmosphere point.
Right.
To us, that was a pacing issue as well. Like, we wanted it to feel like that, but we also thought that at the end of the game, when you're finally reaching a conclusion, it wasn't something that maybe you wanted to come back and be like, now you're right before the climax, now go back low again. Like, we wanted to keep that sort of tension ramping up to the end, so it becomes more focused.
Interesting. Yeah, I think that was my favorite part of the game, though, by far. That part where it did actually open up.
We didn't want it to overstay its welcome as well. I know it's a big thing sometimes with open world games. Like, at the end, there's like a whole other island that's opened or something. And you're kind of like,
right,
I'm a little bit over this.
Yeah,
I
yeah. Did you guys do user testing and stuff?
Of course, yeah.
You did. So did it not frustrate you with people who would just go... like shoot through the open world section, because you could if you wanted to, right? You could just beeline for the thing that says.
I think it's funny, that's more of a developer issue, because you worry that people are going to do that, and the interesting thing is almost no one does that.
Oh, really?
Because if you create a world that's as inviting for exploration, or you successfully create that feeling that that's not something you want to do, then you don't have people do that. And obviously that was a worry. We were worrying about how people were going to receive to that. To that idea,
right?
And they're just going to skip all this stuff that we made,
right?
But when people come back and they're like, "Yeah, I just spent 8 hours on that."
No, no kidding. No, it's exactly. And I didn't even like. I just felt like, okay, I should probably move on. But there's more stuff that I could have done.
In a way, we didn't think everyone was going to do everything, but I guess it's like a completionist thing. You see lots of people saying, "I did everything," and then went on. And
no, totally. Yeah, it's a big thing.
Yeah, we're like, oh, we didn't expect to be that long, but
interesting.
Yeah.
What about the half-eaten apple in the very first level? Is there meaning to that?
What?
You know what I'm talking about. You know what I'm talking about. In the very first level where the house is on fire, apropos of nothing, there's like a half-eaten apple on the floor. And I'm wondering if somebody just like left that there on accident in the like design process, or
I don't know. I should not answer this. So it's the guy in the window thing for
God
you.
God damn it.
The apple floor.
That's super lame. So some of Easter eggs that I just saw reading up on it for this, the giant crow, I didn't know about that. That didn't come out till a while, I guess. You can like make a giant crow appear on that level we were talking about, right?
Yeah, the open world section. I don't remember the exact conditions to do it, but it's another hidden crow.
It's tough as hell, and that gets you like 60,000 gel.
I don't remember the number, but yeah.
60,000.
It's very generous.
Trust me, I know more about this game than you do, okay? So just sit back and let me talk about it for a while.
How many happy apples or models are you using?
What about, give me something that only you would know. Give me some juice. Give me some trivia, Easter egg. Have people found everything?
I don't. Obviously, I'm not looking at everything online. But
you don't go to like a YouTube video and go like all Evil Within 2 secrets just to see.
No, I
guess somebody at this table does.
That's a thing, man. Yeah, people do that.
It's literally, I can see it open in your browser. It's just like
that shit has a couple like hundreds of thousands of views. It's not just me. That's a thing.
I don't know. I can go check. I mean, to me, the biggest surprises are when we see speedruns and stuff like that.
Mm.
Like, even internally, we're like, oh, you can beat it this long, and people find a way to do it even faster.
Have you seen, like, major sequence breaks and stuff like that?
Yeah, we have, and I was more amazed, like, I'm surprised it still works. You know, like...
Right. The game
think about,
still...
Like,
because it wasn't designed to work that way, you mean?
Well, I mean, most of these speedrun... I remember watching, like, those Metroid Prime speedruns where they just, like, skip entire sections of the game, and I was like, how did the triggers even hit? And...
Mm.
I don't know. It's amazing.
Can I talk about something I was very disappointed in?
What?
You cannot shoot, generally, crows or rats in the game, which is like a Mikami thing. He has trained us now for years and years and years to be like, you see a rat or crow like in the distance, shoot that fucking thing, because if you can hit it, you're going to get something really good. And you didn't have it. Was there any talk at any point in the process?
It didn't come up.
Adding that? Are you serious?
You can kill a crow. You just said you can kill a crow.
No, there's that one giant crow that comes up. But in general, you can't like shoot crows like RE4 style and have them drop, you know, money or ammo or like golden eggs and that kind of shit.
There's your first DLC right there. Like,
jeez, did you know that was a thing in the previous games?
Even telling me now, you could do that. Yeah, I was. Yeah. I'm almost surprised. I didn't even remember.
Wow. All right.
I'm sorry.
why again? Lots of like general and specific ones mixed in. Why, when you're in the marrow, there's the maps are on the walls a lot. What was that done intentionally to be like, hey, the users are getting lost here, let's keep showing the map? It's the only part in the game where there's just maps actually shown in as part of the environment. Well,
they even that area even has a map of what would be the entire map of Union if it's not broken apart. So it's just supposed to be obviously a logistics center for how Union and the STEM is working. So the idea is that they planned it out.
Because so that's not like a for users or something like that. I was just wondering, like, literally every entrance you go into it has a big map on the wall saying like, okay, and you are here.
You could use it if you want to, but it's obviously world building stuff.
Okay,
it's cool. People like maps. There's a map in our game. There wasn't a map in the first game.
what about the UI elements, like the getting spotted and stuff? So you took the eye from the first game and reused it, but it works kind of differently now this time, right?
I think it's pretty similar. I'm trying to remember if there were any super differences.
You don't even know.
No, because I think the whole point was bring that bit back to that from the first game. So it might be a slight adjustment because
it communicates more. Like it searches around if they know or aware of you, but they don't know where you are, etc., etc. But we'll just move on.
Yes.
Mark's tough day.
What about stuff?
What value are these questions?
You talked about this.
That's Mark's personal
this
value.
This is trivia. This is stuff people are into the game. What do you think? You get to just sit here and talk about fucking Japanese literature the entire time? You got to answer some fucking meat and potatoes questions too. Okay.
This is the eaten apple is the meat.
Yes, these are the things that people want to know. Trust me, I fucking worked in games journalism for a long time. The apple question is solid gold. You mentioned speedrunners. Did you notice like upgrade paths? Of course, when we the game came out and we were asking you, hey, what should I upgrade first? Of course, you give this fucking diplomatic mealy mouthed answer of like,
you can do whatever you want.
However you want to play the game. It depends on how you want to play the game, blah, blah, blah. Of course, we know now that's bullshit and you should throw it all in stealth. But I'm wondering, for speedrunners, have you noticed a way that most speedrunners seem to do their upgrade path as the like fastest way through the game? Like, is there some speedrunner strategy now that you see where you're like, oh, okay, yeah, that if you wanted to just rifle through it as fast as possible, that's kind of what you would do?
I haven't noticed.
You're just full of shit. You have.
I don't know.
Really? I think you're not watching the
fastest
speedruns?
For the fastest possible.
Well, just like speedrunners, what are they throwing their shit into?
I imagine it's based off probably gun accuracy and anything related to speed. There's the sneak speed up and stuff like that. So,
gun accuracy to like get rid of enemies quicker,
no,
or
so your aim is more precise.
No, I know gun accuracy, but I mean, like in a what's the purpose?
I'm gonna like treat this as a hostile witness now. You're like outright becoming like fucking no answer, hostile answers. Like, come on.
I don't have an answer.
Dig deep. Talk about hooks to the first game and how important it was to do callbacks to the first game, but I guess you have to balance that against like, okay, we have to explain this so people who don't do it are not lost. I mean, you had stuff like the cat, right? From the DLCs.
Yeah.
The obviously the parts where the black bars come back in and stuff like that. Like, how important, I guess, talk about those decisions, like how you hook into the first game and pay some things off from the first game.
Well, obviously it's a sequel, a direct sequel. We want people to understand the elements of the first game, mm-hmm. From a story perspective. But it also factors in later as a gameplay element, especially like the Theodore boss fight and things like that. So, and as a character, Sebastian obviously would have gone through the events of the first game and been affected by them somehow. And returning to that same place would affect him. So we knew that we wanted to have these hooks that would remind you that it was an experience that the player had. Not just sort of like, hey, remember that thing that happened 3 years ago?
Right.
So, yeah, it was tough, you know. To show that actually, yeah, it was pretty scary and it affects him and it's something that he has to overcome, because that's kind of a main point to the game, is sort of that Sebastian overcoming these past elements that he feels that either he couldn't do or things that have affected him personally.
Right.
For example, saving his daughter is a major one.
Why are you laughing, Kermit?
I'm like, just,
don't worry. We're gonna skip through these.
Where did the cat?
oh, you
see like three more pages of questions. Yeah, no, it's time to move on.
Do you want to talk about the cat and coffee?
I was just gonna ask. Are you like a big cat fan or something? Because like actually, that's very memorable to me. The fact that the cats are with the saving, like for some reason. But not, now that you mentioned it,
from
I was
the
like,
DLCs,
yeah,
that's a big thing if you haven't played them. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But it's like, where did that come from?
I guess it's a personal thing. My family has a black cat, and when we were doing DLC stuff, we knew we wanted to do some kind of different way of saving the game. It was very, very bizarre. It was a very small point that we kind of focused on making different. And then the...
rather than the mirror and the music playing every time.
Yeah, it kind of was like, if that's Sebastian's thing, how can Kid have her own thing?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because, again, these stories are maybe tied to the personal journey of the character. And just that kind of popped up because, again, the first game maybe didn't have those areas where you kind of felt at ease. Even the going to the mirror and going to the safe room didn't feel safe. But since this was going to be a shorter experience that was constantly high tension, we're like, how can we make a point where you kind of feel like, I'm taking a breather. And we're like, well, probably petting a cat.
Nice.
You don't feel like you're at risk. Because I
love that.
When I'm home, that's all I do. I play with the cat. And
what about the coffee? Is that a similar thing then in Evil Within 2?
I mean, that came up. That was an idea that came up from the team. Surprisingly, not me, because I'm like super obsessed with coffee.
Yeah, I know. Exactly, yeah.
But obviously, I was like, oh, this is such a great idea.
Brilliant, done, approved. It's in the game.
Yeah, but again, another thing that kind of made you feel at ease, you just kind of like take a breather.
Right.
And I think it's great. I mean, that's the first thing I do when I go back to the save room. I just get a cup of coffee.
Every time. All right, this one, I don't even know what it means, but I took this note down when I play the game. I'm hoping you will understand. Your record's been spotty up until now, but answer me this. This is a very quick question, but like, okay, cutscene with Kidman that shows bio readout. I think it's towards the end of the game. It shows some kind of bio readout. It says something about like 5 dead, 5 something else. You only see it for like a second. Is that stuff real? Like the information that's displayed in that thing? Is that something that's actually like real and canon, or is that just like random, like, oh,
it should be
designer?
It should be real.
Interesting. Okay, that's cool. See, there you go. It's not so hard.
Oh, I can give you I can give you one thing that's interesting.
Okay.
We're talking about the coffee. It's an example of me proposing an idea that gets shot down immediately is like, I was like, the more coffee you drink, the worse his aim gets because he's on like this caffeine high.
He gets jittery.
Yeah, he gets jittery and
and they shot that down.
Yeah, they're like, is that fun? It's like, no, it's kind of goofy. Like, why am I wasting our time with that?
Let's see. The best around lines. There's a couple joke lines in the game. There's one if you go all the way back to, what's his name, O'Neill, after you unlock the movie theater, and they make a joke about the name of the game. And then there's another with, like, if you get the record in the puzzle game, like the shooting puzzle game thing or something like that, maybe you unlock everything. There's, like, you're the best around, never gonna...
Yeah. The shooting game was meant to be a little bit lighter in feeling, so obviously a lot of those are very comedic. I still like the line, I think, when you get all of the rewards... What does he go? He's like, I think I better get back to my whole finding my daughter.
Yeah,
thing.
Yeah, yeah. That part. And also another thing I didn't know until this, if you get all of your upgrades, like the nurse like is just sitting there and goes, yay! And she has like a little whee!
Oh, she's like
little
yeah,
party
you
thing.
To,
like, great, you did everything.
Yeah, you don't have to collect any more of that green gel, I guess.
That's right. Yeah, exactly.
Although we did a lot of those like Easter eggs. I think if you go to her, if you play classic mode, because you can't upgrade, and you sit in the chair, she'll scold you.
She mocks
like,
you. Yeah. What are you doing here?
Yeah.
There's no quick 180 in Evil Within 2.
There is.
You
haven't played this game.
I was just watching. I mean, I did put a question mark on it, but
there,
like,
there's a quick 180.
Do you do it the same way as
I think
in
it's back in
most games?
Is
X?
It back in X or
really?
Back in Stealth, I think.
That's really weird. Did you patch that in or something?
No, it was at the beginning.
Just now, in the middle of this podcast.
Why dialogue trees, and why can you skip dialogue only sometimes? Like, what was the thinking behind like having dialogue trees?
I think all dialogue trees can be skipped. No,
some dialogue can be skipped and some can't. Just okay. In general.
Maybe it's a loading thing. I don't know. But yeah, we have these characters in the most survival horror games that you remember. Like, there's always like a character in a room, and you kind of felt safe, and you're like, why can't I just like. You want to come with me or something like that? You right. want to talk to these people. So it just kind of felt weird that, especially if we're trying to build Sebastian as a character, that he wouldn't speak to these people who were in these rooms. So we just wanted to add things to talk about. Because they're questions that maybe the player also has about certain aspects of the game.
Right. But why not just present that as like a cutscene where you go through all of the stuff? Do you want to have the option for the player just...
Yeah, it was just an option.
Skip
yeah.
it and run out.
I mean, pretty... That was kind of a core concept, having a lot of... You know, things that you don't need to do. We're not forcing you to do anything. If you don't want to know anything about the world, we're not going to force you about it.
Interesting. So. Okay.
I wish all games were like that. Like, I want all that stuff to be optional. Like, I mean, let me decide, you know? Don't decide for me.
What about... I mean, I think there's pretty few jump scares, just, like, pure jump scares in the game. Was that a intentional? Is that a philosophical thing? Like, what's fair to do with a jump scare and not? I think there's, like, two mirrors... both used for jump scares. I think the only like jump scares in the game are both times it comes from like a mirror. But like was that a philosophical stance or did that just end up that way?
I don't know. There was never a point where we're like no jump scares. If there's a time and place I think for them, and if we can think of a situation where it works, and there are some places where we do use them, it works. I know that definitely the sort of focus for the horror this time, like I said, was a little bit less on gore and maybe more on psychological horror. And to us, that was more about sort of this overarching sort of dread that you just kind of felt, which goes in, for example, as you're exploring a town, you just want to kind of feel it that's there. You're not kind of constantly popping out being like, you know?
Right.
You kind of get, it kind of gets frustrating when that happens multiple times. So we just wanted to have this very lingering fear that, or this tension that's there through the whole game.
Hmm.
But yeah, so it worked when we put it in, that's where we thought it would work. But
how did Father Theodore get hurt? How did he get his facial scar? You have some backstory for that?
I don't have it for you.
Is that DLC? Is that DLC one? DLC yeah. one. Father Theodore's life story. First person mode. How did first person mode come about? Why wasn't that in there from the start? There's that section of it in the game, and there was like a console command, right, where you could. Do it in the PC version. I think early.
I mean, there's
on.
Lots of things you can pull out from the PC version,
right?
Cameras and stuff. But it was just another aspect of gameplay that we kind of wanted to try.
Yeah.
But we knew that we wanted it to be a third person experience.
Why?
So just how you know continuing with Evil Within 1 was, and kind of just going with how it was presented. We wanted to keep that aspect of the gameplay there.
There was no thinking as you were developing it, like trying in first person, being like, oh shit, this is really cool when it's in first person. Like, you know, I mean, it brings different things to the...
It definitely does, but what we wanted to do was still in that third person realm, the sort of the character story. But it's obviously an area of interest, so that's why we included it as like a... We messed around with it, and we have like a little section of the game that has it in there. And obviously we need to debug it, so we have codes like that. And some people found that out, and then the response was people were really interested in just seeing the game through that perspective, so we wanted to bring that back and have people
still like a free update out. Basically
yeah.
Or,
okay. Yeah,
I remember when stuff. You remember back in the day, Mark, Code Veronica, like I still have a build of Code Veronica Dreamcast that's first person, like that had a first person mode, which they took out from the release game. I think they might have put it back in years later in some like update, like on a modern console or something. But yeah, it definitely changes like the feeling of a horror game when you're playing in first person.
Yeah, like just wrapping up. These are like fan theories and fan questions and stuff like that. Are you ready? Are you laughing at your fans?
I'm not gonna
mocking your fans. Oh, why do you care so much about this game that I spent 4 years of my life on? What's wrong with you people?
I don't really think I could accurately answer a fan theory.
Why not? You don't know what the questions are. For example, why doesn't Kidman tell him at the start that his wife is working with them? That's tell Sebastian at the start that this is again spoiler territory, but like
we've already spoiled the whole game, so I think it's fine.
Is there any like in fiction reason why she wouldn't want to just tell
him? That's explained in the game.
Is
that's
it?
Obviously a secret plan to topple Mobius, so they're not gonna blurted out in front of like everyone else who's working there.
Oh, so the other people don't know. I mean, she's just talking to Sebastian, but isn't that another reason, like, to recruit him? Like, hey, you should do this because your wife is in there too. And...
It was meant to be a secret.
All right.
Don't want to spill the beans.
Why, when they sent in the other people, O'Neill, all those people with guns and fucking loaded for bear, why did they send Sebastian in with nothing?
Next question.
All right. Convenient for gameplay. Got it. Yeah, there was actually a line in it that I was wondering if this was at least intentional, where I think it's Sebastian that even says it, or maybe it's O'Neill, but it's like, he says, it doesn't have to make sense, you just have to do it. He's asking, like, why do I have to do this? Why do I have to do whatever? It doesn't make any sense.
Oh, why,
and he says, like, it doesn't have to make sense, you just have to do it.
Why is City Hall floating in the air? It's like...
Is that what it was?
He's referencing about the world collapsing. It's like...
But he was asking, like, why he had to do something. And it was like, just do it.
It was... I think it was a logic question about this stuff. And it is very bizarre and surreal, so it was right. Maybe a little bit tongue-in-cheek about some of the elements of the game.
Hmm. What about, like, streams and playthroughs? Like, any interesting stuff that you learned about the game, even after playing it for so long, that you... I mean, we mentioned about the speedrunners breaking stuff, but, like, anything specific stand out in terms of, like, oh, wow, I learned something about the game that I worked on for so long by...
I mean, most of it was kind of like, it was gameplay oriented, like, oh, I didn't think that you can do it in, not in that order, but like you can get through that room that quickly, or if you lob the grenade or lob the, like, shoot a crossbow bolt from here, you can get that and stuff like that.
Right.
It's like minor bug check stuff, but like when you make a game like this, you play it like a billion times. So you have a pretty good idea. So yeah.
So there were not a ton of huge, like, I don't know.
It wasn't like a
mind
blowing one. I mean, I remember for the first game, the mind blowing one was someone who beat like the Akamu mode with like just punching and without leveling up or something like that. And we were just like,
yeah.
Wow. No, I mean, like, super props. Like, we just didn't think it was possible.
Yeah, that's cool.
A lot of the stuff.
Just a couple user questions and then I think we're done. We let you off the hook. This is from user Lyndon Curry. One of the most impressive parts of Evil Within 1 is how often I felt I was going to run out of ammo, but I still had enough to handle a situation. How much time and effort goes into tweaking that, and what's the philosophy around, like, ammo levels in general?
Is that
just a lot of user testing? Or?
No, it's tricky, because it's, for that you kind of have to trust your instincts, and that's how we did it for most of the game. It's pretty much the last thing you do. So you go back and forth. You have these periods where, like, you have way too much ammo, and then you have nothing. And then you constantly just go back and forth.
How can you even judge anymore yourself, though, when you've been playing the game for a year and a half solid? You just have to go on your gut?
There was a lot of it was gut instinct, but what you can do is you can rotate people on the team. Like, this person hasn't played this mode in a month or something, so we can pull them back. And the tricky thing is that once you know, it's obviously different, but you get a general feeling, like... you know, just it's way easier than I remember like from a month ago or something like that.
And, right.
But it's very chaotic at the end. You're doing it like constantly. You're playing through stuff, and yeah, it's a lot of number crunching too, but a lot of it's gut.
Really? So like damage numbers and how much damage enemies take and stuff. Same kind of deal there, where you're like, I think the flamethrower guy is still a little too hard. Let's like dial him back
down.
Yeah,
there's stuff like that.
Yeah. Does any of that change in any patches? Is there any stuff you regret now that you think, oh, you know what, this guy's probably a little too hard or a little too easy or anything?
No, there's nothing we regret that we took out in a patch. So, yeah, I think, you know, it was very, like I said, it was very chaotic in the end. But I think when we got through it, I think we nailed it to an extent because we were very happy to see sort of people who play through the whole game, which is our intention and stuff like that. People didn't really get stuck on things that maybe kind of caught them on the first game.
It felt like you guys spent a lot of time playtesting and like polishing at the very end too, because I remember you telling us like a fair bit before, like, oh, we're almost done, and then like it was a long time until the game came out. So it seems like you guys probably spent a lot of time at the end just sort of fine-tuning. I mean, that's kind of my experience with a lot of Japanese games. Like, I don't know what Western development is like so much, but I know in Japan there's often like months spent at the end just to fine-tune stuff. But was that your guys' experience too?
Well, you know, with the survival horror title, that sort of final adjustment on, you know, items and stuff like that can like make or break it. So we definitely kind of
So you're going to have to bake in time for that.
Were you moving around when you get weapons and stuff like that constantly as well? Or was that
That's pretty much set.
Okay, so it's more ammo and
drop rates and things like that.
That's interesting. Thanks to a lot of other people whose questions we ended up using in the main, or that came up in the questioning, Electric Burgers, Michael Dankwa. A bunch of other folks. Yeah, anything else? What about the white shirt and Fujidu? Who comes up with those, your like in-game advertisement stuff?
Amazing concept art team has some.
But are things where you're like, this is a little weird kind of Japanese stuff, but I'm going to leave it in on purpose? Or were they all stuff where you're like,
I don't know. Nothing stuck out as like, oh, this doesn't work.
Right.
So, I remember that about the first game, though. Like, I actually got to the point where I would stop and look at all the magazine covers and the photos and everything, because they had they had weird shit on. I mean, like, in a good way. Like, I was like, oh, what else
movie
did they do?
Titles,
they
spent a lot of time. Chainsaw 3D. The white shirt was my favorite. I don't know why. That one's just like
the final shirt.
The final shirt?
The final white shirt or something.
Oh, my God. Yeah. That was good. So yeah, what about the future? What are you guys working on now? Like, is there any, you guys did two things of DLC. There's no season pass for Evil Within 2, was there?
We haven't announced it.
Okay. Can people look forward to more stuff, or what are you guys talking about?
Well, I don't have anything to announce, but we're always working on cool stuff that we're really excited to show you.
We like cool stuff. That's cool. Was a lot of extra work to add the first person mode? Did you have to do a lot more testing and that sort of thing mostly? Or what went into that?
Everything's hard work, Mark.
Okay. Apparently including making fucking pigeons and crows and rats shootable,
our team worked really hard for everything that you were able to play, so I'm very thankful to them. They're fantastic.
You heathens! Yeah. Cool. Yeah, any message to the fans? Let's end this as a proper like Japanese style interview. What's your message for the fans? You must have been asked that a lot, like in the lead up. You know, you did all the publicity and stuff, right?
There were some interviews, yes.
Yeah.
I saw a lot of interviews with like you and like very sexy like girls at TGS.
You're explaining what a flamethrower is to like these like super cutesy like Japanese girl interviewers that
TGS. As far like I'm just for people who haven't given a try or are interested but maybe didn't fit in their schedule for the busy 2017, mm-hmm. Definitely look it up. You know, we have the first-person mode added to it, but it's also a good game without the first-person mode, so you can have lots of time. It's a very meaty game, too. I'm sure you can say from experience. But
meaty.
Meaty. For those who have played it, thank you so much. We're all really...
Well, they didn't say they liked it or not.
Oh.
They just played it.
Okay.
See, you want to ruin my interview? I can ruin yours, okay?
So everyone who's supported us all the years, thank you so much. To people who have yet to support us, we welcome you. And
you have some fans. There's some lore videos out there.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. Why? Okay. You should fucking go to YouTube.
I know
there's
the lore.
A site called youtube.com.
I see it's still open on your browser.
You can actually put the name of your game in there and see videos people made about your game. It's pretty amazing.
Maybe I've watched one or two.
Yeah. Okay. Why don't we take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to do like the quickest news roundup ever. So stick around for that. All right, and we're back with the new segment of podcast listener questions. Super fast version because we went way over on our amazing scintillating interview with Jojo, who's still here and could chime in on these questions if he's not looking at his smartphone the entire time. Dermot, give me the new theme song for the listener questions. Go.
Quest, 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 questions.
Okay. Well, you can work on that. So we got questions here about Japan and games and Japanese games. Thank you for everyone who sent it in. Things that don't get used this time, we can use potentially in following weeks. Any cherry blossom viewing plans in store? Eating Big Mac while walking amongst the trees. I think, Graham, they're talking about you there. That's from BB Bahankta Brian from Twitter. Thank you for the question.
Always.
Yeah.
Always.
Every year.
We always have cherry blossom viewing
when
plans.
Are cherry
it always
blossoms
rains and it's always cold.
Going to be this year, do you
end
know?
Of March, beginning of April, same as the last 10 years. Everybody says it's different every year. It's always like the exact same week.
No, it's different. It's sooner or later, dude. You've pushed it. You've pushed the cherry blossom viewing sooner or later because it ends up being colder or warmer.
It's always between one Saturday and the next Saturday. And it's just a matter of one of those two. But yes, it's like the last.
But you picked the wrong Saturday.
We
and
have.
It's like a cold, terrible, freezing cold one. No, I say if you do.
Yeah, Graham, you came out once for the morning thing, right?
I did.
Yeah.
It
like
enjoyable.
We went out there at like I go out
it
every
sucked.
Year
it was
at
awful.
5:45 in the morning to
yeah.
hold
I
the
did
spot
bring McDonald's
because you
did.
Have to bring a mat
and it was
and save
yeah.
the spot. Oh wow, so the Big Mac thing was actually
no. I don't think I've ever had a Big Mac
based on fact.
No, it's a Mac morning, whatever they call. I don't know what they call it in the West, but
Mac
you know,
mornings.
Gotta have that McDonald's breakfast. Yes,
yeah,
we do,
friends,
and we have
man.
A big party every year, and it's awesome, and it only happens because one guy and a helper of his choosing, who happened to be Graham one year, goes out there at 5:45 like a trooper and stands out there in any weather and stays there for like 6 hours so 100 other people can come and have a good time.
Yeah, I'm not doing that this year.
Here's a game question from friend of the show, Adam Ballard, that also ties into what we were just talking about. I've never identified with a character more than using coffee pots to save points in Evil Within 2. What are your favorite quirky save systems in games?
No more
Anybody
heroes.
A good one? Oh, yeah?
Yeah, you save, you sit on the toilet.
Or something? Oh, yeah, that's right. The toilet.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, no, you
heroes.
Do.
No more
heroes.
3, maybe.
I mean, it's no more heroes. Come on, let's be real. Don't, like, give me a shocked look like, oh, what? You, like, yeah, because you, I'm sure, do that all over that game.
That's how you charge your sword.
Right?
Yeah.
It is. It's the easy answer, but I still have the typewriter. I still have a affinity for that.
It's weird that that's the only thing that comes to mind. There's got to be other stuff that you use to save. Like,
what are you doing in Deadly Premonition? Is it coffee again? What's
I don't like think I played far enough in Deadly Premonition to get past the save point because that game was so bizarre. Although, yeah, for me, it would probably be a typewriter too. But Resident Evil was always like stood out as being interesting and different.
I like the red square from Silent Hill 2. You just look at it.
Wait, really?
You don't remember that?
No.
It's just a red square.
I totally don't remember that at all.
And you look at it and then you can save. And
yeah, it's just like save.
A lot of saving things are gone because of auto-saving, right? Like, there aren't a lot to
remember. Definitely
remember.
Less, like, yeah, it's like, it seems like it's less important. Sometimes it gets confusing in games. And actually, with Evil Within 2, I think this was the case where, like, you didn't necessarily know if it all when it was auto saving all of the time, like when it had saved last, when if you died, where you would go back to exactly.
Isn't that how it is in a lot of games? Like,
some games.
I mean, most games today are not don't do that well.
But a lot of games
like.
Show that like oh auto saving and like a thing appears or.
We had an indication, by the way.
You did?
Yeah.
What was it?
It said autosave.
I think have to have an indication. I think it's like a TRC thing. So.
No, but I think there's other things, like the beginning of a chapter or anything? Aren't there points that it didn't, where it would save, that it didn't necessarily say autosaving?
It should say it.
You don't know about your own games. So
bug test.
I can trust
bug report.
You. So how many of 8-4 staff can legitimately make it to 8-4 in Super Mario Brothers? All caps without warping. This is from Firquin MC Root.
Kidding?
As an 80s kid who grew up with the NES, I'm always dumbfounded at the amount of people who cannot beat Super Mario Brothers. This not only means younger gamers are a surprising number of in my own age group. Thanks for the
Has
question.
Anyone at this
I'm
table
looking at
not
you younger
done that?
People.
I haven't done it.
You've really? Never done it?
Have you tried?
No, I don't. No.
You've done it with.
I mean, maybe. Warp. Maybe I've done it.
Have you finished Super Mario Brothers ever?
No.
My God,
it should be a requirement. Am I missing? Gotta change the bylaws to make that a requirement of working here, Graham.
You can, but at least probably. This person can feel superior to me. Like I gave them that.
You did give them that.
You
yeah.
can play it about an hour, man.
I've done it. I mean, it's fun. It's enjoyable to actually do it.
There's some
you
weird
get to
levels.
See levels that most people never see because
exactly.
they always skip over them.
Yeah, there are, and there's some of the like world seven
world
levels.
Six,
and
world
stuff.
6 and 7 are very interesting, and a lot of people just skip them because they go from 4 to 8.
I mean, I'll be honest though. If I grew up in an era where there were as many games as there are around now or really have been in like the last 20 years. I mean, Super Mario Brothers was all you played for like 6 months to a year,
yeah,
right? And
yeah.
it was like hey, let's check out, you know, random ass World 5-2 or whatever. Like, let's try doing this for half an hour on that world.
But I think I tried to do it on the Lost levels, and I didn't succeed. At some point, I got fed up and just stopped because, like, it was super, super hard after, like, World 9 or whatever.
As amazing as Warp Zone was, it is kind of a shame in a sense. And the same thing with the Warp Whistle and stuff in Super Mario Bros. 3. It ends up de facto, like, people never play a lot of levels in the game, you know? It ends up being just like you skip through it. So, Roy.
So it's like, I don't care.
Yeah. Overwatch League signs the first female player. Awesome. That's cool. That's good news. Which team was it that signed it? It's the Shanghai Dragons. Okay. I'd heard that they might. Well, rumor or report that Smash Brothers title will be announced and released for Switch later this year. I think that's no surprise to anybody. I think we've been calling at this table, but this is maybe more solid confirmation that it's coming out this year. Somebody mentioned like a recent Switch firmware added like compatibility of a
GameCube controller.
The GameCube controller,
the GameCube controller.
And then they took it out, right?
I didn't hear about that.
Pretty sure it went in and then it went out like pretty quickly, but
because that also seemed like a potential hint.
Yeah, like I mean that. I think Smash Brothers being on Switch is actually relatively exciting because I feel like having it on two systems last platform watered it down for a lot of people. For me, anyway, I was like, there's too much Smash Brothers to stay on top of.
Right.
Like,
the 3DS version had all the good stages.
That's true.
Yeah.
Magic Ant. Yeah.
I agree. There's a kind of a phenomena there where, like, in the Fire Emblem as well, was it Echoes that had the three versions of it?
It was Fates.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It kind of lessens the value of any single one of them.
I just want nice one focused Smash Bros. Right? On Switch. That'll be cool.
It's the same one that everybody's playing. And speaking of Switch, Doom got motion controls in a recent
update.
That's
really cool.
Interesting.
I would like to see more games doing that.
Why? So this got a lot of play and a lot of news, but I thought that that's something most people didn't like. I mean, some people play Splatoon that way, I guess.
That's the definitive way to play Splatoon. If you're competitive in Splatoon, you have to use motion controls.
Wow. Just because you have more movement. It's like playing with a mouse, whatever, you have more.
Yeah, well, it's like playing with a mouse, you know? Yeah. And they do the same thing in like the Zelda games.
For what?
Splatoon?
Yeah, with the tilt
the motion?
Control? Yeah, right. I did because I said on Twitter that that's the dumb way to do it, and then everybody yelled at me to do it that way.
Oh,
so
okay.
I tried it, and if you get used to it, it's pretty good.
Huh. Yeah, it's much more precise. And like I was saying, they do it in the 3D Zelda games on 3DS, where you can guide your bow that way, and they did it on Wii U as well. But you haven't really seen any other developers take it up, so it's interesting to see it like come in with Doom.
It's always weird when you hear about it like added to a game that didn't plan it initially. Like that worries me a little bit.
Hmm. Yeah. It's just kind of control. Well, yeah. I guess. It could, if it's not designed for that, it can be in the same way that adding mouse control to a game that's not designed for it can make it weird. Mega Man Legacy Collection 1 and 2 coming to Switch in May.
Woo.
Some Evil Within 2 game got a first person update.
Woo.
No one cares. especially not John Johannes. January NPD, Monster Hunter.
Killed it.
Yep. Number one over Call of Duty, PUBG, etc. I mean, those are older games, so it's kind of not
fair. Dragon Ball FighterZ up there as well.
Dragon Ball FighterZ number two. Although I guess there's been a serious drop off in the amount of people playing Dragon Ball Z FighterZ. Have you heard this?
That's going to happen for every fighting.
It's par for the course for any fighting game, but like
retention is actually a lot better retention is a lot better than most games.
There was like 80% fall off in the first.
It's a lot more than most. That's good. Keeping 20% of the player base is good for a fighting game. Most people just jump on, and then they get their asses kicked, and they just leave. So,
Okay. I've heard a lot of people talking about that it's actually, like, you know, that it's still an arc game, and that it's actually surprised a lot of people who would normally not be surprised because they're like, oh, it's Dragon Ball. And they start to play it, and they're like, oh, what? I don't know what
it's
the
fuck. It's nowhere close to an arc game. It's no Guilty Gear.
Well, right, but for the average person that's just expecting, like, a Dragon Ball game.
Didn't it sell, like, over a million copies?
Yeah,
I think it's doing really well.
It's selling very well.
It's selling like crazy.
It sold record numbers. It had the record for, I think, most concurrent players of any fighting game on Steam.
Yeah, yeah.
And then very quickly also had, like,
but that's part of the course,
steep
so
drop-off.
It's not surprising.
Okay. Metal Gear Survive, like, came out, apparently, by the way. I literally didn't know this until I was listening to another podcast after it already
came out.
Came out
a couple days ago.
Yeah, wow.
No reviews up, though, as of this recording.
Yesterday.
Is anybody here going to play it?
No.
I'd be curious if Monster Hunter hadn't just come out.
Yeah,
if
I had time, I would definitely at least check it out as a curiosity. I mean, I think it does bode interesting things for the future of that franchise and also just Konami in general that I would want to check out. But I don't know what it bodes exactly yet. It doesn't maybe sound great so far, given that especially that I didn't even know that it had come out. It didn't seem like a lot of people were talking about it on Twitter, although I'm not on social media all the time.
Metal Gear don't interest you. It's like,
I mean, I thought that was kind of an interesting angle that they... given that it's the Fulton thing, that that wormhole thing, I thought that was like, oh, okay. I mean, if you have to do that, I guess that's a fun way to connect it.
Wormholes,
I mean, if you have to like wedge zombies into your zombie mode into your game, Sonic the Hedgehog film, a JoJo. I know you're excited about this. Got to go fast. Sonic the Hedgehog film dated for November 2019.
Stoked. Is it like CG or is it live action
mixed.
What?
So Sonic's going to be CG and then everything else is going to be live action.
It's going to be that game where Sonic like makes out with the human woman. Basically that.
Yeah, the best one.
An hour and a half of that. I bet you like that. New Kingdom Hearts 3 trailer shows Monsters, Inc. world. Does anybody... Are we now totally... Oh, no, Roy, you're still here.
Yeah, I'm still here.
I was just wondering if now that JJ is gone, if nobody cared about Kingdom Hearts at all anymore.
I don't think JJ cares.
JJ didn't really care.
I'm the only one. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get Dermot.
I'm interested moderately. The new theme song's kind of crap, which is a bummer.
It's not that bad.
It's not that bad.
It's so much worse than the last two. Come on.
Well, it's not even the full song
yet. She shouldn't
yet.
Speak in English. She shouldn't sing in English, I mean.
Why?
No, some of her
good.
English stuff.
The lyrics are terrible. Lyrics like written by like a no.
That's an opinion.
Yeah, it's a correct one.
final bit of news. Friend of the show, Swery, and Arc System Works, speaking of the devil, announced a new project, The Missing.
The Missing what? What is Missing?
Just The Missing.
It's The Missing.
The Missing. Being developed in-house at his new company, White Owls. So their other project, The Good Life, is being built at Grounding. Just a reminder, I think that
the Kickstarter is kicking
off.
Up again soon.
Yeah,
the Kickstarter is kicking off.
Yeah.
He says, "Quote: This title will blow your mind. I think it's sick."
Hell yeah.
So yeah, and it says it will be released this year. Interesting on the Arc System Works website. Doesn't seem like there's much other information or details about the game. That's about it. Missing has many meanings. Missing person, someone who's lost or everything lost. Maybe it's your loved one or place you belong. Do you ever feel blah, 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 blah? It doesn't really say what it is. But we'd love to see more and excited to see the rest. And I think that does it. So, like, sorry for the truncated news and user sections. User questions, thank you again for everyone who sent those in, and please keep doing that.
And
was
we're
great.
Keeping the ones that came in, too. It's not they're not going to get used just because we didn't use them now.
That's
but we
right.
do need to sit down when we have a week where we have time to talk about stuff and actually come up with a name for that segment, because we don't have one yet.
Or not. We can just keep evolving. But in the meantime, while we're doing that, what should the people be doing? The listeners be doing?
They should be finding us on Dermot Look Horrified right now, like as if he was supposed to do that unprepared. You can find us on the
someday,
interwebs.
Dermot, you will need to take up the gauntlet.
I know.
Yeah, when you edit the podcast tomorrow, record this part and just put it on your phone so you can listen to it over and over again. You can find us on the interwebs at 8-4.jp or on our second home at giantbomb.com, who kindly hosts us, and also on Twitter's 8-4play. Or my Twitter is JohnTV. Mark, where can they find you?
Mark MacD.
Dermot.
I'm at Dermalo.
Roy.
At Kotori.
Graham.
At Timely Howard.
JoJo, what about you? Where's your Twitter?
Oh, yeah.
No. At John Johannes.
John Johannes.
That's my name.
Easy enough.
Sweet.
Or we're on Facebook. We're on iTunes. We're on all that other junk.
Reset our...
That's right. There's a Thread and Reset our... You can put your questions in there, too. We got some from there as well. But other than that, we'll be back. Will we be back? We'll be back in 2 weeks.
Somebody will
yes,
be
Yes, we'll
back.
Be back. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We got one more before GDC.
That's
so,
right.
Until then, it's always customary for our guests to take us out. JoJo?
I'm going to stab the shit out of you.
Perfect.
So you see, Craigy, it's all set up. All you gotta do is push the rocket delivery button.
I'm just a hologram.
That makes two of us.
Using the crystal.
Diddy, push the big red button.
He can't. You can be here, you can be there, anywhere. You can go any place you wanna go, don't you know? You're just an image of yourself floating in the air. Can't lift a thing, and you can't even comb your hair. A hologram is like a telegram. You can send it anywhere, but you're never gonna wear. You gotta realize your limitations when you're just thin air. Hold on a second there, I'm not finished now. Where was I? Oh yeah. You can't peel bananas that you wanna eat. You can't feel the ground with your own 2 feet.
You can't even eat bananas?
Oh, how many times do I gotta tell you?
You got
a hologram is like a telegram. You can send it anywhere, but you're not really there. You can't touch anything. Longer should I sing? Don't you understand that holograms can't push red buttons?